Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
There are definitely from the beginning also references to the kind of education that he has received. When he's going to, he's describing the meeting on the campus, and he says he's going there. As I stand, and I stand in the circle where three roads converge near the statue, where we drilled four abreast down the smooth asphalt and pivoted and entered the chapel on Sundays. Our uniforms pressed, shoes shined, minds laced up, eyes blind like those robots to visitors and officials on the low whitewashed reviewing stand. You know, one of the things I reflected upon in light of something you mentioned from the previous show, you had stated that one of your guests had really broke down a system of domination. Will always have to, or will be most effective when it seizes three areas of control. I forget the name of the guest. I'm sure you'll recall, but you said that the three areas of control were, I believe, war, education, and religion, specifically the relation to the Creator. Is that correct? Are those?
That is correct.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. What was the guest in Khalid? What was his?
I believe that was Dr. Khalid Muhammad. He was here.
Khalid Muhammad.
Yes, sir.
Okay, let me write that down this time. Didn't quite get the whole name. But yes, and it struck me that those three areas of control are very much on display throughout this book, and they often converge on these images of the machine or the reduction of the black body of black men and women to machines or to robots. We have here in this image, he says, we drilled four abreast. They are made into regiments. It is a kind of a quasi-military formation in which they are taking place. It says their eyes were blind like robots. It seems to be a result of the kind of education they're being given, which is different from the consciousness that the narrator later achieves. What he seems to achieve at the end is the ability to look through deception, to look through illusions, and when he looks through illusions, what he sees is a world of possibilities. But what he sees at this point is a world of necessity, where he must do what is expected of him at each moment, and this seems to be a result of the education here that is figured as a kind of almost military inculcation, and again, it's also taking place within a kind of substitute religion. That was also present in the scene of the Battle Royale, where it was commented that it looked like the boys were praying. It was creating a situation where they are being compelled to worship these symbols of wealth and power. But one of the things I think is most powerful about the image of the machine in this book, in the reduction of human beings to machines, is precisely what it means in terms of that relationship to the Creator, what it means in terms of religion, but that specific analytical category of Mr. Khalid Muhammad, that if the human being is reduced to a machine, that severs the relationship to the creator. A machine is something that is man-made and is controlled by men. And it is not something for which a connection to the creator is acknowledged. Or rather, there is a creator, but the creator becomes human rather than divine. And so any human being that is placed in that status is placed in a position of lower order with relationship to the creator. And Ellison is very explicit about how this works, for example, in the context of the school. For example, when Mr. Norton comes to the school, it is announced, already the creator has come, and it's with a capital C. In other words, those who are at the school who is producing, the school that is producing these robot-like beings, are within a system that has been created by a creator. They are the creations then of a human system, and one that would deny their relationship to a divine creator. I think that's a key distinction throughout. Well, we even see it when he's. I was going to say it's even earlier. I've just invoked, you know, the idea that Mr. Norton, who is among those who has founded this school, is being referred to as the creator. One of the things the narrator has been asked to do is his responsibility is to drive Mr. Norton around, and he simply follows Mr. Norton's directions and goes wherever Mr. Norton wants him to go. But one of the last things conversations he has with Mr. Norton is the end of chapter four. The narrator says to the guest of the campus, he says, "Will you need me this evening, sir?" I ask, and Mr. Norton says, "No, I won't be needing the machine." Right. So the narrator says, "Will you need me?" And the answer is, "No, I won't need the machine." So even in that answer, Mr. Norton is directly equating the narrator with the car and referring to it as the machine, as that general category. That in his mind and in that response, in his relationship to the narrator, he sees him merely as the machine. The me is the machine in that relation.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, May 18th, 2018. So I have been told this is our weekly book club, third installment, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, one of Gus T's all-time favorites. Top five book from Gus T. Renegade. We are picking up on chapter four. Again, I want to remind listeners that this book, the audiobook, they do not announce the chapters when we get to the beginning of a new chapter. So you'll just have to be alert when there's a lengthy pause before he starts the next sentence. That is probably the beginning of a new chapter. This week we will be challenged because we're starting chapter four. Chapter four and chapter five are very short. Chapter six is very lengthy, and it's lengthy, and it's one that is so the brilliance of Ellison is on display, but it's so lengthy that you can't really break it at any point. So we will have to be astute listeners and just do it all in one shot. There will be no second audio clip. It is all one shot. It will be a little bit longer than the way that we normally do the reading, but that is just because of the length of chapter six. I tried and tried and tried, and there was just no place to interrupt the narrative. Just, man, the genius of Ralph Ellison, I think, will carry us through. So now you have been alerted. Quickly, that was Dr. Martin Kevorkian at the beginning of the broadcast. This is, I think, one of the very few times that there is a built-in study guide for the book that we're reading, Within the Cows. Dr. Kevorkian was on the program in 2010 to discuss this book for the entire program. We also had Lena Hill. She was on the program. I played an audio segment from her visit last week. She was with us back in 2011. She is a Ellison biographer, and she's written extensively about this book specifically, repeatedly. She was with us, and that's all we talked about for the whole program was this book. So you can go back and get a lot of amazing insight. I thought what Dr. Kevorkian had to say in that sound clip was really important, particularly for what we are going to hear this week. Without further ado, Context of White Supremacy, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Chapter 4.
The wheel felt like an alien thing in my hands as I followed the white line of the highway. Heat rays from the late afternoon sun arose from the gray concrete, shimmering like the weary tones of a distant bugle blown upon still midnight air. In the mirror, I could see Mr. Norton staring out vacantly upon the empty fields, his mouth stern, his white forehead livid where it had scraped the screen. And seeing him, I felt the fear balled coldly within me unfold. What would happen now? What would the school officials say? In my mind, I visualized Dr. Bledsoe's face when he saw Mr. Norton. I thought of the glee certain folks at home would feel if I were expelled. Tatlock's grinning face danced through my mind. What would the white folks think who'd sent me to college? Was Mr. Norton angry at me? In the golden day, he had seemed more curious than anything else, until the vet had started talking wild. Damn, Trueblood. It was his fault. If we hadn't sat in the sun so long, Mr. Norton would not have needed whiskey, and I wouldn't have gone to the golden day. Why would the vets act that way with a white man in the house? I headed the car through the red brick campus gateposts with a sense of cold apprehension. Now even the rows of neat dormitories seemed to threaten me, the rolling lawns appearing as hostile as the gray highway with its white dividing line. As of its own compulsion, the car slowed as we passed the chapel with its low sweeping eaves. The sun shone coolly through the avenue of trees, dappling the curving drive. Students strolled through the shade down a hill of tender grass toward the brick-red stretch of tennis courts. Far beyond, players in whites showed sharp against the red of the courts surrounded by grass, a gay vista washed by the sun. In the brief interval, I heard a cheer arise. My predicament struck me like a stab. I had a sense of losing control of the car and slammed on the brakes in the middle of the road, then apologized and drove on. Here, within this quiet greenness, I possessed the only identity I had ever known, and I was losing it. In this brief moment of passage, I became aware of the connection between these lawns and buildings and my hopes and dreams. I wanted to stop the car and talk with Mr. Norton, to beg his pardon for what he had seen, to plead and show him tears, unashamed tears like those of a child before his parent, to denounce all we'd seen and heard, to assure him that far from being like any of the people we had seen, I hated them, that I believed in the principles of the Founder with all my heart and soul, and that I believed in his goodness, and that I believed in his own goodness and kindness in extending the hand of his benevolence to helping us poor, ignorant people out of the mire and darkness. I would do his bidding and teach others to rise up as he has wished them to, teach them to be thrifty, decent, upright citizens, contributing to the welfare of all, shunning all but the straight and narrow path that he and the Founder had stretched before us. If only he were not angry with me, if only he would give me another chance. Tears filled my eyes and the walks and buildings flowed and froze for a moment in mist, glittering as in winter when rain froze on the grass and foliage and turned the campus into a world of whiteness, waiting and bending both trees and bushes with fruit of crystal. Then, in the twinkling of my eyes, it was gone, and the here and now of heat and greatness returned. If only I could make Mr. Norton understand what the school meant to me. "Shall I stop at your room, sir?" I asked, "or shall I take you to the administration building? Dr. Bledsoe might be worried." "To my rooms, then bring Dr. Bledsoe to me." he answered tersely. Yes, sir. In the mirror, I saw him dabbing gingerly at his forehead with a crinkled handkerchief. You'd better send the school physician to me also, he said. I stopped the car in front of a small building with white pillars like those of an old plantation manor house, got out and opened the door. Mr. Norton, please, sir, I'm sorry. He looked at me sternly, his eyes narrowed, saying nothing. I didn't know. Please. Send Dr. Bledsoe to me, he said, turning away and swinging up the graveled path to the building. I got back into the car and drove slowly to the administration building. A girl waved gaily as I passed, a bunch of violets in her hand. Two teachers in dark suits talked decorously beside a broken fountain. The building was quiet. Going upstairs, I visualized Dr. Bledsoe, with his broad, globular face that seemed to take its form from the fat pressing from the inside, which, as air pressing against the membrane of a balloon, gave it shape and buoyancy. Old Buckethead, some of the fellows called him. I never had. He had been kind to me from the first, perhaps because of the letters which the school superintendent had sent to him when I arrived. But more than that, he was the example of everything I hoped to be. Influential with wealthy men all over the country, consulted in matters concerning the race, a leader of his people, the possessor of not one, but two Cadillacs, a good salary and a soft, good-looking and creamy-complexioned wife. What was more, while black and bald and everything white folks poked fun at, he had achieved power and authority, had, while black and wrinkle-headed, made himself of more importance in the world than most southern white men. They could laugh at him, but they couldn't ignore him. He's been looking all over for you, the girl at the desk said. When I walked in, he looked up from the telephone and said, Never mind, he's here now, and hung up. Where's Mr. Norton? He demanded excitedly. Is he all right? Yes, sir. I left him at his rooms and came to drive you down. He wishes to see you. Is anything wrong? He said, getting up hurriedly and coming around the desk. I hesitated. Well, is there? The panicky beating of my heart seemed to blur my vision. Not now, sir. Now! What do you mean? Well, sir, he had some kind of fainting spell. Oh, my God! I knew something was wrong. Why didn't you get in touch with me? He grabbed his black Homburg, starting for the door. Come on! I followed him, trying to explain. He's all over it now, sir, and we were too far away for me to phone. Why did you take him so far? He said, moving with great bustling energy. I drove him where he wanted to go, sir. Where was that? Back of the slave quarter section, I said with dread. The quarters? Boy, are you a fool? Didn't you know better than to take a trustee out there? He asked me to, sir. We were going down the walk now, through the spring air, and he stopped to look at me with exasperation, as though I'd suddenly told him black was white. Damn what he wants, he said, climbing in the front seat beside me. Haven't you the sense God gave a dog? We take these white folks where we want them to go. We show them what we want them to see. Don't you know that? I thought you had some sense. Reaching Rab Hall, I stopped the car, weak with bewilderment. Don't sit there, he said. Come with me. Just inside the building, I got another shock. As we approached a mirror, Dr. Bledsoe stopped and composed his angry face like a sculptor, making it a bland mask, leaving only the sparkle of his eyes to betray the emotion that I had seen only a moment before. He looked steadily at himself for a moment. Then we moved quietly down the silent hall and up the stairs. A co-ed sat at a graceful table stacked with magazines. Before a great window stood a large aquarium containing colored stones and a small replica of a feudal castle surrounded by goldfish that seemed to remain motionless despite the fluttering of their lacy fins, a momentary, motionful suspension of time. Is Mr. Norton in his room? He said to the girl. Yes, sir, Dr. Bledsoe, sir, she said. He said to tell you to come in when you got here. Pausing at the door, I heard him clear his throat, then rap softly upon the panel with his fist. "Mr. Norton," he said, his lips already a smile, and at the answer I followed him inside. It was a large, light room. Mr. Norton sat in a huge wing chair with his jacket off. A change of clothing lay on the cool bedspread. Above a spacious fireplace, an oil portrait of the founder looked down at me, remotely, benign, sad, and in that hot instant, profoundly disillusioned. Then a veil seemed to fall. "I've been worried about you, sir," Dr. Bledsoe said. "We expected you at the afternoon session." Now it's beginning, I thought. Now. And suddenly he rushed forward. "Mr. Norton, your head," he cried, a strange grandmotherly concern in his voice. "What happened, sir?" "It's nothing." Mr. Norton's face was immobile. "A mere scratch." Dr. Bledsoe whirled around, his face outraged. "Get the doctor over here," he said. "Why didn't you tell me that Mr. Norton had been injured?" "I've already taken care of that, sir," I said softly, seeing him whirl back. Mr. Norton, I'm so sorry," he crooned. "I thought I had sent you a boy who was careful, a sensible young man. Why, we've never had an accident before. Never, not in 75 years. I assure you, sir, that he shall be disciplined, severely disciplined." "But there was no automobile accident," Mr. Norton said kindly, "nor was the boy responsible. You may send him away. We won't need him now." My eyes suddenly filled. I felt a wave of gratitude at his words. "Don't be kind, sir," Dr. Bledsoe said. "You can't be soft with these people. We mustn't pamper them. An accident to a guest of this college while he is in the charge of a student is without question the student's fault. That's one of our strictest rules." Then to me, "Return to your dormitory and remain there until further notice." "But it was out of my control, sir," I said, "just as Mr. Norton said." "I'll explain, young man," Mr. Norton said with a half smile. "Everything will be explained." "Thank you, sir," I said, seeing Dr. Bledsoe looking at me with no change of expression. "On second thought," he said, "I want you to be in chapel this evening. Understand me, sir?" "Yes, sir." I opened the door with a cold hand, bumping into the girl who had been at the table when we went inside. I'm sorry, she said. "Look like you have old buckethead kind of mad." I said nothing as she walked beside me expectantly. A red sun cast its light upon the campus as I started for my dormitory. "Will you take a message to my boyfriend for me?" she said. "Who is he?" I said, trying hard to conceal my tension and fear. "Jack Maston," she said. "Okay, he's in the room next to mine." "That's swell," she said with a big smile. "The dean put me on duty, so I missed him this afternoon. Just tell him that I said the grass is green." "What?" "The grass is green. It's our secret code. He'll understand." "The grass is green," I said. "That's it." "Thank you, lover," she said. I felt like cursing as I watched her hurrying back into the building, hearing her flat-heeled shoes crunching the graveled walk. Here she was playing with some silly secret code at the very minute my fate for the rest of my life was being decided. The grass was green, and they'd meet, and she'd be sent home pregnant. But even so, in less disgrace than I. If I only knew what they were saying about me. Suddenly I had an idea, and ran after her into the building and up the stairs. In the hall, fine dust played in a shaft of sunlight, stirred by her hurried passing. But she had disappeared. I had thought to ask her to listen at the door and tell me what was said. I gave it up. If she were discovered, I'd have that on my conscience, too. Besides, I was ashamed for anyone to know about my predicament. It was too stupid to be believed. Down the long length of the wide hall, I heard someone unseen skipping down the stairs, singing. a girl's sweet, hopeful voice. I left quietly and hurried to my dorm. I lay in my room with my eyes closed, trying to think. The tension gripped my insides. Then I heard someone coming up the hall and stiffened. Had they sent for me already? Nearby, a door opened and closed, leaving me as tense as ever. To whom could I turn for help? I could think of no one. No one to whom I could even explain what had happened at the Golden Day. Everything was upset inside me, and Dr. Bledsoe's attitude towards Mr. Norton was the most confusing of all. I dared not repeat what he'd said, for fear that it would lessen my chances of remaining in school. It just wasn't true. I had misunderstood. He couldn't have said what I thought he had said. Hadn't I seen him approach white visitors too often with his hat in his hand, bowing humbly and respectfully? Hadn't he refused to eat in the dining hall with white guests of the school entering only after they had finished and then refusing to sit down but remaining standing, his hat in his hand, while he addressed them eloquently, then leaving with a humble bow? Hadn't he? Hadn't he? I had seen him too often as I peeped through the door between the dining room and the kitchen. I, myself. And wasn't his favorite spiritual, Live a Humble? And in the chapel on Sunday evenings upon the platform, hadn't he always taught us to live content in our place in 1,000 unambiguous words? He had. And I had believed him. I had believed without question his illustrations of the good which came of following the founder's path. It was my affirmation of life, and they couldn't send me away for something I didn't do. They simply couldn't. But that vet, he was so crazy that he corrupted sane men. He had tried to turn the world inside out. God damn him! He had made Mr. Norton angry. He had no right to talk to a white man as he had, not with me, to take the punishment. Someone shook me and I recoiled, my legs moist and trembling. It was my roommate.
"What the hell, roomie?" he said. "Let's go to chow."
I looked at his confident mug. He was going to be a farmer. "I don't have an appetite," I said with a sigh.
"Okay now," he said. "You can try to kid me, but don't say I didn't wake you."
"No," I said.
"Who you expecting, a broad butt gal with ball bearing hips?"
"No," I said.
"You better stop that, roomie," he grinned. "It'll ruin your health, make you a moron. You ought to take you a gal and show her how the moon rises over all that green grass on the founder's grave. Man, go to hell," I said.
He left laughing, opening the door to the sound of many footsteps from the hall, supper time, the sound of departing voices. Something of my life seemed to retreat with them into a gray distance, moiling. Then a knock sounded at the door, and I sprang up, my heart tense. A small student wearing a freshman's cap stuck his head in the door, shouting,
"Dr. Bledsoe said he wants to see you down at Rab Hall."
And then he was gone before I could question him, his footsteps thundering down the hall as he raced to dinner before the last bell sounded. At Mr. Norton's door, I stopped, with my hand on the knob, mumbling a prayer. "Come in, young man," he said to my knock. He was dressed in fresh linen, the light falling upon his white hair as upon silk floss. A small piece of gauze was plastered to his forehead. He was alone. "I'm sorry, sir," I apologized, "but I was told that Dr. Bledsoe wanted to see me here." "That's correct," he said, "but Dr. Bledsoe had to leave. You'll find him in his office after chapel." "Thank you, sir," I said and turned to go. He cleared his throat behind me. "Young man," I turned hopefully. "Young man, I have explained to Dr. Bledsoe that you were not at fault. I believe he understands." I was so relieved that at first I could only look at him, a small, silken-haired, white-suited Saint Nicholas, seeing through misty eyes. "I certainly do thank you, sir," I managed finally. He studied me silently, his eyes slightly narrowed. "Will you need me this evening, sir?" I asked. "No, I won't be needing the machine. Business is taking me away sooner than I expected. I leave late tonight." "I could drive you to the station, sir," I said hopefully. "Thank you, but Dr. Bledsoe has already arranged it." "Oh," I said with disappointment. I had hoped that by serving him the rest of the week, I could win back his esteem. Now, I would not have the opportunity. "Well, I hope you have a pleasant trip, sir," I said. "Thank you," he said, suddenly smiling. "And maybe the next time you come, I'll be able to answer some of the questions you asked me this afternoon." "Questions?" His eyes narrowed. "Yes, sir, about your fate," I said. "Ah, yes. Yes," he said. "And I intend to read Emerson, too." "Very good. Self-reliance is a most worthy virtue. I shall look forward with the greatest of interest to learning your contribution to my fate." He motioned me toward the door. "And don't forget to see Dr. Bledsoe." I left somewhat reassured, but not completely. I still had to face Dr. Bledsoe, and I had to attend chapel. At the sound of vespers, I moved across the campus with groups of students walking slowly, their voices soft in the mellow dusk. I remember the yellowed globes of frosted glass making lacy silhouettes on the gravel and the walk of leaves and branches above us as we moved slow through the dusk, so restless with scents of lilac, honeysuckle, and verbena, and the feel of spring greenness. And I recall the sudden arpeggios of laughter lilting across the tender springtime grass, gay-welling, far-floating, fluent, spontaneous, a bell-like feminine fluting, then suppressed, as though snuffed swiftly and irrevocably beneath the quiet solemnity of the vesper air, now vibrant with somber chapel bells. Dong, dong, dong. Above the decorous walking around me, sounds of footsteps leaving the verandas of far-flung buildings and moving toward the walks and over the walks to the asphalt drives lined with whitewashed stones, those cryptic messages for men and women, boys and girls, heading quietly toward where the visitors waited. And we, moving not in the mood of worship, but of judgment, as though even here in the filtering dusk, here beneath the deep indigo sky, here alive with looping swifts and darting moths, here in the here-ness of the night not yet lighted by the moon that looms blood-red behind the chapel like a fallen sun, its radiance shedding not upon the here dusk of twittering bats nor on the there night of cricket and whippoorwill, but focused short-rayed upon our place of convergence. And we, drifting forward with rigid motions, limbs stiff and voices now silent, as though on exhibit even in the dark, and the moon, a white man's bloodshot eye. And I move more rigid than all the others with a sense of judgment. The vibrations of the chapel bells stirring the depths of my turmoil, moving towards its nexus with a sense of doom. And I remember the chapel with its sweeping eaves, long and low, as though risen bloody from the earth like the rising moon, vine-covered and earth-colored, as though more earth-sprung than man-sprung. and my mind rushing for relief away from the spring dusk and flower scents, away from the time scene of the crucifixion to the time mood of the birth, from spring dusk and vespers to the high, clear, lucid moon of winter and snow, glinting upon the dwarfed pines where instead of the bells, the organ and the trombone choir speak carols to the distances drifted with snow, making of the night air a sea of crystal water lapping the slumbering land to the farthest reaches of sound for endless miles, bringing the new dispensation even to the golden day, even unto the house of madness. But in the here-ness of dusk, I am moving toward the doom-like bells through the flowered air beneath the rising moon. Into the doors and into the soft lights I go, silently, past the rows of puritanical benches, straight and torturous, finding that to which I am assigned and bending my body to its agony. There at the head of the platform, with its pulpit and rail of polished brass, are the banked and pyramided heads of the student choir, faces composed and stolid above uniforms of black and white, and above them, stretching to the ceiling, the organ pipes looming, a Gothic hierarchy of dull, gilded gold. Around me, the students move with faces frozen in solemn masks, and I seem to hear already the voices mechanically raised in the songs the visitors loved. Loved, demanded, sung, an ultimatum accepted and ritualized, an allegiance recited for the peace it imparted, and for that, perhaps, loved. Loved as the defeated come to love the symbols of their conquerors, a gesture of acceptance, of terms laid down and reluctantly approved. And here, sitting rigid, I remember the evening spent before the sweeping platform in awe and in pleasure, and in the pleasure of awe, remember the short formal sermons intoned from the pulpit there, rendered in smooth, articulate tones with calm assurance, purged of the wild emotions of the crude preachers most of us knew in our hometowns and of whom we were deeply ashamed, these logical appeals, which reached us more like the thrust of a firm and formal design, requiring nothing more than the lucidity of uncluttered periods, the lulling movement of multisyllabic words to thrill and console us. And I remember, too, the talks of visiting speakers, all eager to inform us of how fortunate we were to be part of the vast and formal ritual, how fortunate to belong to this family sheltered from those lost in ignorance and darkness. Here, upon this stage, the black rite of Horatio Alger was performed to God's own acting script, with millionaires come down to portray themselves, not merely acting out the myth of their goodness and wealth and success and power and benevolence and authority in cardboard masks, but themselves, these virtues concretely, not the wafer and the wine, but the flesh and the blood, vibrant and alive, and vibrant even when stooped, ancient and withered, and who, in face of this, would not believe, could even doubt. And I remember, too, how we confronted those others, those who had set me here in this Eden, whom we knew, though we didn't know, who were unfamiliar in their familiarity, who trailed their words to us through blood and violence and ridicule and condescension, with drawling smiles, who extorted and threatened, intimidated with innocent words as they described to us the limitations of our lives and the vast boldness of our aspirations, the staggering folly of our impatience to rise even higher, who, as they talked, aroused furtive visions within me, of blood froth sparkling their chins like their familiar tobacco juice, and upon their lips the curdled milk of a million black slave mammies' withered dugs, a treacherous and fluid knowledge of our being, imbibed at our source and now regurgitated foul upon us. This was our world, they said as they described it to us, this our horizon and its earth, its seasons and its climate, its spring and its summer and its fall and harvest some unknown millennium ahead, and these its floods and cyclones, and they themselves our thunder and lightning. and this we must accept and love, and accept even if we do not love. We must accept, even when those were absent and the men who made the railroads and ships and towers of stone were before our eyes in the flesh, their voices different, unweighted with recognizable danger, and their delight in our songs more sincere seeming, their regard for our welfare marked by an almost benign and impersonal indifference. But the words of the others were stronger than the strength of philanthropic dollars, deeper than shafts sunk in the earth for oil and gold, more awe-inspiring than the miracles fabricated in scientific laboratories. For their most innocent words were acts of violence to which we of the campus were hypersensitive, though we endured them not. And there, on the platform, I too had stridden and debated, a student leader directing my voice at the highest beams and farthest rafters, ringing them, the accents staccato upon the ridgepole and echoing back with a tinkling like words hurled to the trees of a wilderness or into a well of slate-gray water, more sound than sense, a play upon the resonances of buildings, an assault upon the temples of the ear. Ha! To the gray-haired matron in the final row. Ha! Miss Susie Gresham, back there looking at the co-ed, smiling at the he-ed. Listen to me, the bungling bugler of words, imitating the trumpet and the trombone's timbre, playing thematic variations like a baritone horn. Hey, old connoisseur of voice sounds, of voices without messages, of newsless winds, listen to the vowel sounds and the crackling dentals, to the low, harsh gutturals of empty anguish, now riding the curve of a preacher's rhythm I heard long ago in a Baptist church, stripped now of its imagery, no suns having hemorrhages, no moons weeping tears, no earthworms refusing the sacred flesh and dancing in the earth on Easter morn, ha, singing achievement, ha, booming success, intoning, ha, acceptance, ha, a river of word sounds filled with drowned passions, floating, ha, with wrecks of unachievable ambitions and stillborn revolt, sweeping their ears, ha, ranged stiff before me, necks stretched forward with listening ears, ha, a spraying the ceiling and a drumming the dark stained after rafter, that seasoned cross arm of torturous timber mellowed in the kiln of a thousand voices playing, ha, as upon a xylophone, words marching like the student band up the campus and down again, blaring triumphant sounds empty of triumphs. Hey, Miss Susie, the sound of words that were no words, counterfeit notes singing achievements yet unachieved, riding upon the wings of my voice out to you, old matron who knew the voice sounds of the founder and knew the accents and echo of his promise, your gray old head cocked with the young around you, your eyes closed, face ecstatic as I toss the word sounds in my breath, my bellows, my fountain, like bright colored balls in a water spout. Hear me, old matron, justify now this sound with your dear old nod of affirmation, your closed eye, smile, and bow of recognition, who'll never be fooled with the mere content of words, not my words, not these pin-feathered flighters that stroke your lids till they flutter with the ecstasy, with but the mere echoed noise of the promise. And after the singing and outward marching, you seize my hand and sing out quavering, boy, someday you'll make the founder proud. Ha! Susie Gresham, Mother Gresham, guardian of that hot young woman on the Puritan benches who couldn't see your Jordan's water for their private steam. You relic of slavery, whom the campus loved but did not understand. Aged of slavery, yet bearer of something warm and vital and all-enduring, of which in that island of shame we were not ashamed. It was to you on the final row I directed my rush of sound, and it was you of whom I thought with shame and regret as I waited for the ceremony to begin. The honored guests moved silently upon the platform, herded toward their high, carved chairs by Dr. Bledsoe, with the decorum of a portly head waiter. Like some of the guests, he wore striped trousers and a swallow-tailed coat with black braided lapels topped by a rich ascot tie. It was his regular dress for such occasions, yet For all its elegance, he managed to make himself look humble. Somehow, his trousers inevitably bagged at the knees and the coat slouched in the shoulders. I watched him smiling at first one and then another of the guests, of whom all but one were white. And as I saw him placing his hand upon their arms, touching their backs, whispering to a tall, angular-faced trustee who in turn touched his arm familiarly, I felt a shudder. I too had touched a white man today, and I felt that it had been disastrous. And I realized then that he was the only one of us whom I knew, except perhaps a barber or a nursemaid, who could touch a white man with impunity. And I remembered, too, that whenever white guests came upon the platform, he placed his hand upon them as though exercising a powerful magic. I watched his teeth flash as he took a white hand. Then, with all seated, he went to his place at the end of the row of chairs. Several terraces of students' faces above them, the organist, his eyes glinting at the console, was waiting with his head turned over his shoulder, and I saw Dr. Bledsoe, his eyes roaming over the audience, suddenly nod without turning his head. It was as though he had given a downbeat with an invisible baton. The organist turned and hunched his shoulders. A high cascade of sound bubbled from the organ, spreading thick and clinging over the chapel, slowly surging. The organist twisted and turned on his bench, with his feet flying beneath him as though dancing to rhythms totally unrelated to the decorous thunder of his organ. And Dr. Bledsoe sat with a benign smile of inward concentration. Yet his eyes were darting swiftly, first over the rows of students, then over the section reserved for teachers, his swift glance carrying a threat for all. For he demanded that everyone attend these sessions. It was here that policy was announced in broadest rhetoric. I seemed to feel his eyes resting upon my face as he swept the section in which I sat. I looked at the guests on the platform. They sat with that alert relaxation with which they always met our upturned eyes. I wondered to which of them I might go to intercede for me with Dr. Bledsoe, but within myself, I knew that there was no one. In spite of the array of important men beside him, and despite the posture of humility and meekness which made him seem smaller than the others, although he was physically larger, Dr. Bledsoe made his presence felt by us with a far greater impact. I remembered the legend of how he had come to the college, a barefoot boy who in his fervor for education had trudged with his bundle of ragged clothing across two states, and how he was given a job feeding slop to the hogs, but had made himself the best slop dispenser in the history of the school, and how the founder had been impressed and made him his office boy. Each of us knew of his rise over years of hard work to the presidency, and each of us at some time wished that he had walked to the school or pushed a wheelbarrow or performed some other act of determination and sacrifice to attest his eagerness for knowledge. I remembered the admiration and fear he inspired in everyone on the campus. The pictures in the Negro press captioned "Educator" in type that exploded like a rifle shot, his face looking out at you with utmost confidence. To us, he was more than just a president of a college. He was a leader, a statesman who carried our problems to those above us, even unto the White House. And in days past, he had conducted the president himself about the campus. He was our leader and our magic, who kept the endowment high, the funds for scholarships plentiful, and publicity moving through the channels of the press. He was our cold black daddy, of whom we were afraid. As the organ voices died, I saw a thin brown girl arise noiselessly with the rigid control of a modern dancer high in the upper rows of the choir and begin to sing a cappella. She began softly, as though singing to herself of emotions of utmost privacy, a sound not addressed to the gathering, but which they overheard almost against her will. Gradually, she increased its volume until at times the voice seemed to become a disembodied force that sought to enter her, to violate her, shaking her, rocking her rhythmically, as though it had become the source of her being rather than the fluid web of her own creation. I saw the guests on the platform turn to look behind them to see the thin brown girl in white choir robe standing high against the organ pipes, herself become, before our eyes, a pipe of contained, controlled, and sublimated anguish. A thin, plain face transformed by music. I could not understand the words, but only the mood, sorrowful, vague, and ethereal of the singing. It throbbed with nostalgia, regret, and repentance. And I sat with a lump in my throat as she sank slowly down, not a sitting, but a controlled collapsing, as though she were balancing, sustaining the simmering bubble of her final tone by some delicate rhythm of her heart's blood, or by some mystic concentration of her being, focused upon the sound through the contained liquid of her large, uplifted eyes. There was no applause, only the appreciation of a profound silence. The white guests exchanged smiles of approval. I sat thinking of the dread possibility of having to leave all this, of being expelled, imagining the return home and the rebukes of my parents. I looked out at the scene now from far back in my despair, seeing the platform and its actors as though a reversed telescope, small, doll-like figures moving through some meaningless ritual. Someone up there, above the alternating moss-dry and grease-slick heads of the students rode before me, was making announcements from a lectern on which a dim light shone. Another figure rose and led a prayer. Someone spoke. Then around me, everyone was singing, lead me to a rock that is higher than I. And as though the sound contained some force more impervious than the image of the scene of which it was the living connective tissue, I was pulled back to its immediacy. One of the guests had risen to speak. A man of striking ugliness, fat, with a bullet head set on a short neck with a nose much too wide for its face, upon which he wore black-lensed glasses. He had been seated next to Dr. Bledsoe, but so concerned had I been with the president that I hadn't really seen him. My eyes had focused only upon the white man and Dr. Bledsoe, so that now, as he rose and crossed slowly to the center of the platform, I had the notion that part of Dr. Bledsoe had arisen and moved forward, leaving his other part smiling in the chair. He stood before us, relaxed, his white collar gleaming like a band between his black face and his dark garments, dividing his head from his body, his short arms crossed before his barrel like a black little Buddha's. For a moment, he stood with his large head lifted as though thinking. Then he began speaking, his voice round and vibrant, as he told us of his pleasure in being allowed to visit the school once more after many years. Having been preaching in a northern city, he had seen it last in the final days of the founder when Dr. Bledsoe was the second in command. "Those were wonderful days," he droned. "Significant days. Days filled with great portent." As he talked, he made a cage of his hands by touching his fingertips. Then, with his small feet pressing together, he began a slow, rhythmic rocking, tilting forward on his toes until it seemed he would fall, then back on his heels, the lights catching his black-lensed glasses until it seemed that his head floated free of his body and was held close to it only by the white band of his collar. And as he tilted, he talked until a rhythm was established. Then he was renewing the dream in our hearts. This barren land after emancipation, he intoned. This land of darkness and sorrow, of ignorance and degradation, where the hand of brother had been turned against brother, father against son, and son against father, where master had turned against slave and slave against master, where all was strife and darkness and aching land. And into this land came a humble prophet, lowly like the humble carpenter of Nazareth, a slave and a son of slaves, knowing only his mother. A slave born, but marked from the beginning by a high intelligence and princely personality. Born in the lowest part of this barren, war-scarred land, yet somehow shedding light upon it where'er he passed through. I'm sure you have heard of his precarious infancy, his precious life almost destroyed by an insane cousin who splashed the babe with lye and shriveled his seed, and how, a mere babe, he lay 9 days in a death-like coma and then suddenly and miraculously recovered. You might say that it was as though he had risen from the dead or been reborn. Oh, my young friends, he cried, beaming, my young friends, it is indeed a beautiful story. I'm sure you've heard it many times. Recall how he came upon his initial learning through shrewd questioning of his little masters, the elder masters never suspecting, and how he learned his alphabet and taught himself to read and solve the secret of words, going instinctively to the Holy Bible with its great wisdom for his first knowledge. And you know how he escaped and made his way across mountain and valley to that place of learning, and how he persisted and worked noontimes, nights, and mornings for the privilege of studying, or, as the old folk would say, of rubbing his head against the college wall. You know of his brilliant career, how already he was a moving orator. Then his penniless graduation and his return after years to this country. And then his great struggle beginning. Picture it, my young friends. The clouds of darkness all over the land, black folk and white folk full of fear and hate, wanting to go forward, but each fearful of the other. A whole region is caught in a terrible tension. Everyone is perplexed with the question of what must be done to dissolve this fear and hatred that crouched over the land like a demon waiting to spring. And you know how he came and showed them the way. Oh, yes, my friends, I'm sure you've heard it time and time again, of this godly man's labors, his great humility, and his undimming vision, the fruits of which you enjoy today, concrete made flesh. His dream conceived in the starkness and darkness of slavery, fulfilled now even in the air you breathe, in the sweet harmonies of your blended voices, in the knowledge which each of you, daughters and granddaughters, sons and grandsons of slaves, all of you partaking of it in bright and well-equipped classrooms. You must see this slave, this black Aristotle, moving slowly, with sweet patience, with a patience not of mere man, but of God-inspired faith. See him moving slowly as he surmounts each and every opposition, rendering unto Caesar that which was Caesar's, yes, but steadfastly seeking for you that bright horizon which you now enjoy. All this, he said, spreading his fingers palm down before him, has been told and retold throughout the land, inspiring a humble but fast-rising people. You have heard it and it, this true story of rich implication, this living parable of proven glory and humble nobility, and it, as I say, has made you free. Even you, who have come to this shrine only this semester, know it. You have heard his name from your parents, for it was he who led them to the path, guiding them like a great captain, like that great pilot of ancient times who led his people safe and unharmed across the bottom of the blood-red sea. And your parents followed this remarkable man across the black sea of prejudice, safely out of the land of ignorance, through the storms of fear and anger, shouting, "Let my people go!" when it was necessary, whispering it during those times when whispering was wisest, and he was heard. I listened, my back pressing against the hard bench with a numbness, my emotions woven into his words as upon a loom. "And remember," he said, "when he entered a certain state at cotton-picking time, his enemies had plotted to take his life. And recall how during his journey he was stopped by the strange figure of a man whose pitted features revealed no inkling of whether he was black or white. Some say he was a Greek, some a Mongolian, others a mulatto, and others still a simple white man of God. Whoever and whatsoever, and we must not rule out the possibility of an emissary direct from above. Oh, yes, and remember how he appeared suddenly, startling both founder and horse as he gave warning, telling the founder to leave the horse and buggy there in the road and proceed immediately to a certain cabin, then slipped silently away, so silently, my young friends, that the founder doubted his very existence. And you know how," the great man continued, "through the dusk, determined, though puzzled, as he approached the town, he was lost in reverie until the crack of the first rifle sounded, then the almost fatal volley that creased his skull, oh my, and left him stunned and apparently lifeless. I have heard him tell with his own lips how consciousness returned while they were still upon him, examining their foul deed, and how he lay biting his heart, lest they hear it and wipe out their failure with a coup de grace, as the French would say. Ha! And I'm sure you've each of you lived with him through his escape," he said, seeming to look directly into my watered eyes. "You awakened when he awakened, rejoiced when he rejoiced at their leaving without further harm, arising when he arose, seeing with his eyes the prints of their milling footsteps and the cartridges dropped in the dust about the imprint of his fallen body, yes, and the cold, dust-encrusted but not quite fatal blood, and you hurried with him, full of doubt, to the cabin designated by the stranger, where he met that seemingly demented black man. You remember that old one, laughed at by the children in the town square, old, comic-faced, crafty, cotton-headed, and yet it was he who bound up your wounds with the wounds of the founder. He, the old slave, showing a surprising knowledge of such matters, germology and scabology," he called it. "And what a youthful skill of the hands! For he shaved our skull and cleansed our wound, and bound it neat with bandages stolen from the home of an unsuspecting leader of the mob. Ha! And you recall how you plunged with the founder, the leader, deep into the black art of escape, guided at first, indeed initiated, by the seemingly demented one who had learned his craft in slavery. You left with the founder in the black of the night, and I know it. You hurried silently along the river bottom, stung by mosquitoes, hooted by owls, zoomed by bats, buzzed by snakes that rattled among the rocks, mud and fever, darkness and sighing. You hid all the following day in the cabin where 13 slept in 3 small rooms, standing until darkness in the fireplace chimney, back in all the soot and ashes, guarded by the granny who dozed at the hearth, seemingly without a fire. You stood in the blackness, and when they came with their baying hounds, they thought her demented. But she knew. She knew. She knew the fire. She knew the fire. She knew the fire that burned without consuming. My God, yes! My God, yes! A woman's voice responded, adding to the structure of his vision within me. And you left him on the morning, hidden in a wagon load of cotton in the very center of the fleece where you breathe the hot air through the barrel of the emergency shotgun, the cartridges, which, thank God, it was unnecessary to use, held fanwise and ready between the spread fingers of your hand. And you went into this town with him and were hidden by the friendly aristocrat one night and on the next by the white blacksmith who held no hatred, surprising contradictions of the underground. Escaping. Yes. Helped by those who knew you and those who didn't know, because for some it was enough to see him. Others helped without even that, black and white, but mostly it was our own who aided, because you were their own, and we have always helped our own. And so, my young friends, my sisters and brothers, you went with him in and out of cabins, by night and early morning, through swamps and hills, on and on, passed from black hand to black hand and some white hands, and all the hands molding the founder's freedom and our own freedom like voices shaping a deep felt song. And you, each of you, were with him. Ah, how well you know it, for it was you who escaped to freedom. Ah, yes, and you know the story. I saw him resting now, and beaming out across the chapel, his huge head turning to all its corners like a beacon, his voice still echoing as I fought back my emotion. For the first time, the evocation of the founder saddened me, and the campus seemed to rush past me, fast retreating like the fading of a dream at the sundering of slumber. Beside me, the student's eyes swam with a distorting cataract of tears, his features rigid as though he struggled within himself. The fat man was playing upon the whole audience without the least show of exertion. He seemed completely composed, hidden behind his black-lensed glasses, only his mobile features gesturing his vocal drama. I nudged the boy beside me. "Who is he?" I whispered. He gave me a look of annoyance, almost of outrage. "Reverend Homer A. Barbie, Chicago," he said. Now the speaker rested his arm upon the lectern and turned toward Dr. Bledsoe. "You've heard the bright beginning of the beautiful story, my friends. But there is the mournful ending, and perhaps, in many ways, the richer side. The setting of this glorious sun of the morning." He turned to Dr. Bledsoe. "It was a fateful day, Dr. Bledsoe, sir, if I may recall it to you, for we were there." "Oh, yes, my young friends," he said, turning to face us again with a sad, proud smile. "I knew him well and loved him. And I was there. We had toured through several states to which he was carrying the message. The people had come to hear the prophet. The multitude had responded. The old-fashioned people, women in aprons and Mother Hubbards of calico and gingham, men in their overalls and patched alpacas, a sea of upturned and puzzled faces looking out from beneath old, battered straw hats and limp sunbonnets. They who had come by oxen and mule team and by walking long distances. It was the month of September and unseasonably cold. He had spoken peace and confidence into their troubled souls, had set a star before them, and we were passing on to other scenes, still carrying the message. Ah, those days of ceaseless travel, those youthful days, those springtime days, fertile, blossomy, sun-filled days of promise. Ah, yes, those indescribably glorious days in which the founder was building the dream, not only here in this then barren valley, but hither and yonder throughout the land, instilling the dream in the hearts of the people, erecting the scaffolding of a nation, broadcasting his message that fell like seed on fallow ground, sacrificing himself, fighting and forgiving his enemies of both complexions. Oh, yes, he had them of both complexions. But going forward, filled with the importance of his message, filled with his dedicated mission, and in his zeal, perhaps in his mortal pride, ignoring the advice of his physician. I see in my mind's eye the fatal atmosphere of that jam-packed auditorium. The founder holds the audience within the gentle palm of his eloquence, rocking it, soothing it, instructing it, and there below the rapt faces blushed by the glow of the big pot-belly stove, now turned cherry red with its glowing. Yes, the spellbound rose caught in the imperious truth of his message. And I hear now again the great humming hush as his voice reached the end of a mighty period. And one of the listeners, a snowy-headed man, leaps to his feet, crying out, "Tell us what is to be done, sir. For God's sake, tell us. Tell us in the name of the son they snatched from me last week." And all through the room, the voices arising, imploring, "Tell us. Tell us." And the founder is suddenly mute with tears. Old Barbie's voice rang out as suddenly he made charged and incomplete movements about the platform, acting out his words. And I watched with a sick fascination, knowing part of the story, yet a part of me fighting against its sad, inevitable conclusion. And the founder pauses, then steps forward with his eyes spilling his great emotion. With his arm upraised, he begins to answer, and totters. Then all is commotion. We rush forward and lead him away. The audience leaps to its feet in consternation. All is terror and turmoil, a moan and a sighing, until like a clap of thunder I hear Dr. Bledsoe's voice ring out, whip-like with authority, a song of hope. And as we stretch the founder upon a bench to rest, I hear Dr. Bledsoe stomping out the time with mighty strokes upon the hollow platform, commanding not in words but in the great gut tones of his magnificent basso. Oh, but wasn't he a singer? Isn't he a singer still today? And they stand, they come, and with him they sing out against the tottering of their giants, sing out their long black songs of blood and bones, meaning hope, of hardship and pain, meaning faith, of humbleness and absurdity, meaning endurance, of ceaseless struggle in darkness, meaning triumph. Ha! Barbie cried, slapping his hands. Ha! Singing verse after verse until the leader revived. Slap, slap of his hands. Address them, slap. My God, assure them, slap. That slap, he was only tired of his ceaseless efforts. Yes, and dismisses them, sending each on his way, rejoicing, giving each a parting handshake of fellowship. I watched Barbie pace in a semicircle, his lips compressed, his face working with emotion, his palms kneading and making no sound. Ah, those days in which he tilled his mighty fields, those days in which he watched the crops take hold and grow, those youthful, summery, sun-bright days. Barbie's voice sighed off in nostalgia. The chapel hardly breathed as he sighed deeply. Then I watched him produce a snowy handkerchief, remove his dark glasses and wipe his eyes, and through the increasing distance of my isolation, I watched the men in the seats of honor slowly shake their spellbound heads. Then Barbie's voice began again, disembodied now, and it was as though he had never paused, as though his words, reverberating within us, had continued their rhythmic flow, though their source was for a moment stilled. Oh, yes, my young friends. Oh, yes, he continued with great sadness. Man's hope can paint a purple picture, can transform a soaring vulture into a noble eagle or a moaning dove. Oh, yes, but I knew, he shouted, startling me. In spite of that great, anguished hope within me, I knew that great spirit was declining, was approaching its lonely winter, the great sun going down. For sometimes it is given one to know these things. And I staggered under the awful burden of that knowledge, and I cursed myself because I bore it. But such was the founder's enthusiasm, oh yes, that as we sped from country town to country town through the glorious Indian summer, I soon forgot. And then, I listened to his voice fall to a whisper. His hands were outspread as though he were leading an orchestra into a profound and final diminuendo. Then his voice rose again, crisply, almost matter-of-factly accelerated. I remember the start of the train, how it seemed to groan as it started up the steep grade into the mountain. It was cold. Frost formed its icy patterns upon the window's edges, and the whistle of the train was long-drawn and lonely, a sigh issuing from the depths of the mountain. In the car up ahead, in the Pullman assigned him by the very president of the line, the leader lay tossing. He had been struck with a sudden and mysterious sickness, and I knew, in spite of the anguish within me, that the sun goeth down, for the heavens themselves conveyed that knowledge. The rush of the train, the clicking of the wheels upon the steel, I remember how I looked out of the frosted pane and saw the looming great North Star and lost it, as though the sky had shut its eye. The train was curving the mountain, the engine loping like a great black hound parallel with the last careening cars, panting forth its pale white vapor as it hurled us ever higher, and shortly the sky was black without a moon, and his moon echoed over the chapel. He drew his chin against his chest until his white collar disappeared, leaving him a figure of balanced, unbroken blackness, and I could hear the rasp of air as he inhaled. It was as though the very constellations knew our impending sorrow, he bugled, his head raised to the ceiling, his voice full-throated, for against that great, wide sweep of sable there came the burst of a single jewel-like star, and I saw it shimmer and break and streak down the cheek of that cold black sky, like a reluctant and solitary tear. He shook his head with great emotion, his lips pursed as he moaned, turning toward Dr. Bledsoe as though he did not quite see him. At that fateful moment, I sat with your great president. He was deep in meditation as we awaited word from the men of science, and he said to me of that dying star, Barbie, friend, did you see? And I answered, yes, doctor, I saw. And at our throats already, we felt the cold hands of sorrow. And I said to Dr. Bledsoe, let us pray. And as we knelt there on the swaying floor, our words were less prayers than sounds of mute and terrible sorrow. And it was then, as we pulled to our feet, staggering with the motion of that speeding train, that we saw the physician moving toward us, and we looked with bated breath into the blank and expressionless features of the man of science, asking with our total beings, do you bring us hope or disaster? And it was then and there he informed us that the leader was nearing his destination. It was said The cruel blow had fallen and we were left numb. But the founder was still, for the moment, with us and still in command. And of all in the traveling party, he sent for him, who sits there before you, and for me, as a man of God. But he wanted mainly his friend of midnight consultations, his comrade of many battles, who over the weary years had remained steadfast in defeat as in victory. Even now I can see as the dark passage lit with dim lights and Dr. Bledsoe swaying as he went before me. At the door stood the porter and the conductor, a black man and a white man of the South, both crying, both weeping. And he looked up as we entered, his great eyes resigned, but still aflame with nobility and courage against the white of his pillow. And he looked at his friend and smiled warmly at his old campaigner, his loyal champion, his adjunct, that marvelous singer of the old songs who had rallied his spirit during times of distress and discouragement, who, with his singing of the old familiar melodies, soothed the doubts and fears of the multitude, who had rallied the ignorant, the fearful and suspicious, those still wrapped in the rags of slavery, him, there, your leader, who calmed the children of the storm. And as the founder looked up at his companion, he smiled, and reaching out his hand to his friend and companion, as I now stretch out my hand to you, he said, "Come closer. Come closer." And he moved closer until he stood beside the berth, and the light slanting across his shoulder as he knelt beside him. And the hand reached out and gently touched him, and he said, "Now, you must take on the burden. Lead them the rest of the way." And oh, the cry of that train and the pain too big for tears. When the train reached the summit of the mountain, he was no longer with us. And as the train dropped down the grade, he had departed. It had become a veritable train of sorrow. Dr. Bledsoe there sat weary in mind and heavy of heart. What should he do? The leader was dead, and he, thrown suddenly at the head of the troops, like a cavalryman catapulted into the saddle of his general, felled in a charge of battle, vaulted onto the back of his fiery and half-broken charger. Ah, and that great, black, noble beast, wall-eyed with the din of battle and twitching already with its sense of loss. What command should he give? Should he return with his burden home to where already the hot wires were flashing, speaking, rattling the mournful message? Should he turn and bear the fallen soldier down the cold and alien mountain to this valley home? Return with the dear eyes dulled, the firm hands still, the magnificent voice silent, the leader cold? Return to the warm valley, to the green grounds he could no longer light with his mortal vision? Should he follow his leader's vision, though he had now himself departed? Ah, of course, you know the story, how he bore the body into the strange city and the speech he made as his leader lay in state, and how when the sad news spread, a day of mourning was declared for the whole municipality. Oh, and how rich and poor, black and white, weak and powerful, young and old, all came to pay their homage, many realizing the leader's worth and their loss only now with his passing. And how, with his mission done, Dr. Bledsoe returned, keeping his sorrowful vigil with his friend in an humble baggage car, and how the people came to pay their respects at the stations. A slow train. A sorrowful train. And all along the line in the mountain and valley, wherever the rails found their fateful course, the people were one in their common mourning, and like the cold steel rails, were spiked down to their sorrow. Oh, what a sad departure. And what an even sadder arrival. See with me, my young friends, hear with me the weeping and wailing of those who shared his labors. Their sweet leader returned to them rock cold in the iron immobility of death, he who had left them quick in the prime of his manhood, author of their own fire and illumination, returned to them cold, already a bronzed statue. Oh, the despair, my young friends, the black despair of black people. I see them now, wandering about these grounds, where each brick, each bird, each blade of grass was a reminder of some precious memory, and each memory a hammer stroke driving home the blunt spikes of their sorrow. Oh, yes, some now are here, gray-haired among you, still dedicated to his vision, still laboring in the vineyard. But then, with the black, draped coffin lying in state among them, inescapably reminding them, they felt the dark night of slavery settling once more upon them. They smelt that old, obscene stink of darkness, that old slavery smell, worse than the rank halitosis of hoary death. Their sweet light enclosed in a black-draped coffin, their majestic sun snatched behind a cloud. Oh, and the sad sound of weeping bugles. I can hear them now, stationed at the four corners of the campus, sounding taps for the fallen general, announcing and re-announcing the sad tidings, telling and retelling the sad revelation one to the other across the still numbness of the air, as though they could not believe it, could neither comprehend nor accept it. Bugles weeping like a family of tender women lamenting their loved one. And the people came to sing the old songs and to express their unspeakable sorrow. Black, 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 black people in blacker mourning. The funeral crepe hung upon their naked hearts, singing unashamedly their black folks' songs of sorrow. Moving painfully, overflowing the curving walks, weeping and wailing beneath the drooping trees, and their low, murmuring voices like the moans of winds in a wilderness. And finally they gathered on the hill slope, and as far as the tear-wet eyes could see, they stood with their heads bowed, singing. Then, silence. The lonesome hole banked with poignant flowers, the dozen white-gloved hands waiting taut upon the silken ropes, that awful silence. The final words are spoken. A single wild rose tossed farewell burst slowly, its petals drifting snow-like upon the reluctantly lowered coffin, then down into the earth, back to the ancient dust, back to the cold black clay, mother of us all. As Barbie paused, the silence was so complete that I could hear the power engines far across the campus throbbing the night like an excited pulse. Somewhere in the audience, an old woman's voice began a plaintive wail, the birth of a sad, unformulated song that died stillborn in a sob. Barbie stood with his head thrown back, his arms rigid at his sides, his fists clenched as though fighting desperately for control. Dr. Bledsoe sat with his face in his hands. Near me, someone blew his nose. Barbie took a tottering step forward. Oh, yes, oh, yes, he said. Oh, yes, that too is part of the glorious story. But think of it not as a death, but as a birth. A great seed had been planted, a seed which has continued to put forth its fruit in its season as surely as if the great Creator had been resurrected. For in a sense, he was, if not in the flesh, in the spirit. And in a sense, in the flesh too, for has not your present leader become his living agent, his physical presence? Look about you if you doubt it, my young friends, my dear young friends. How can I tell you what manner of man this is who leads you? How can I convey to you how well he has kept his pledge to the founder? How conscientious has been his stewardship? First, you must see the school as it was, already a great institution, to be sure, but then the buildings were 8. Now they are 20. Then the faculty was 50. Now it is 200. Then the student body was a few hundred, when now I'm told you are 3,000. And now, where you have roads of asphalt for the passage of rubber tires, then the roads were of crushed stone for the passage of oxen and mule teams and horse-drawn wagons. I have not words to tell you how my heart swelled to return to this great institution after so great a while, to move among its wealth of green things, its fruitful farmland and fragrant campus. Ah! And the marvelous plant supplying power to an area larger than many towns, all operated by black hands. Thus, my young friends, does the light of the founder still burn. Your leader has kept his promise 1,000-fold. I commend him in his own right, for he is the co-architect of a great and noble experiment. He is a worthy successor to his great friend, and it is no accident that his great and intelligent leadership has made him our leading statesman. His is a form of greatness worthy of your imitation. I say to you, pattern yourselves upon him, aspire each of you to someday follow in his footsteps. Great deeds are yet to be performed, for we are a young, though a fast-rising people. Legends are still to be created. Be not afraid when to take the burdens of your leader, and the work of the founder will be one of every unfolding glory. The history of the race, a saga of mounting triumphs. Barbie stood with his arms outstretched now, beaming over the audience, his Buddha-like body still as an onyx boulder. There was sniffling throughout the chapel. Voices murmured with admiration, and I felt more lost than ever. For a few minutes, old Barbie had made me see the vision, and now I knew that leaving the campus would be like the parting of flesh. I watched him lower his arms now and start back to his chair, moving slowly with his head cocked as though listening to distant music. I'd lowered my head to wipe my eyes when I heard the shocked gasp arise. Looking up, I saw two of the white trustees moving swiftly across the platform to where Barbie floundered upon Dr. Bledsoe's legs. The old man slid forward upon his hands and knees as the two white men took his arms, and now, as he stood, I saw one of them reach for something on the floor and place it in his hands. It was when he raised his head that I saw it. For a swift instant, between the gesture and the opaque glitter of his glasses, I saw the blinking of sightless eyes. Homer A. Barbie was blind. Uttering apologies, Dr. Bledsoe helped him to his chair. Then, as the old man rested back with a smile, Dr. Bledsoe walked to the edge of the platform and lifted his arms. I closed my eyes as I heard the deep moaning sound that issued from him and the rising crescendo of the student body joining in. This time, it was music, sincerely felt, not rendered for the guests, but for themselves, a song of hope and exaltation. I wanted to rush from the building, but didn't dare. I sat stiff and erect, supported by the hard bench, relying upon it as upon a form of hope. I could not look at Dr. Bledsoe now, because old Barbie had made me both feel my guilt and accept it. For although I had not intended it, any act that endangered the continuity of the dream was an act of treason. I did not listen to the next speaker, a tall, white man who kept dabbing his eyes with a handkerchief and repeating his phrases in an emotional and inarticulate manner. Then the orchestra played excerpts from Dvorak's New World Symphony, and I kept hearing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot resounding through its dominant theme, my mother's and grandfather's favorite spiritual. It was more than I could stand. And before the next speaker could begin, I hurried past the disapproving eyes of teachers and matrons out into the night. A mockingbird trilled a note from where it perched upon the hand of the moonlit founder, flipping its moon-mad tail above the head of the eternally kneeling slave. I went up the shadowy drive, heard it trill behind me. The street lamps glowed brilliant in the moonlit dream of the campus, each light serene in its cage of shadows. I might well have waited until the end of the services, for I hadn't gone far when I heard the dim, bright notes of the orchestra striking up a march, followed by a burst of voices as the students filed out into the night. With a feeling of dread, I headed for the administration building, and upon reaching it, stood in the darkened doorway. My mind fluttered like the moths that veiled the street lamp, which cast shadows upon the bank of grass below me. I would now have my real interview with Dr. Bledsoe, and I recalled Barbie's address with resentment. With such words fresh in his mind, I was sure Dr. Bledsoe would be far less sympathetic to my plea. I stood in the darkened doorway trying to probe my future if I were expelled. Where would I go? What would I do? How could I ever return home?
Context of White Supremacy, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Still don't have the applause button, but the brilliance of Ralph Ellison. Wow. What a pleasure to read the book, and huge commendations to Joe Morton, not for his work on Scandal, but for brilliant narration. I mean, wow, they could not have picked a better person to voice. I mean, wow. What? Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, narrated by Joe Morton. Gus T. Renegade, top five pick, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. I do not remember the last time that I was, or I do, it was Medical Apartheid, Harriet A. Washington, also in my top five. I think I said that before, just being in awe of the brilliance of Miss Washington. Once again, Ralph Ellison. And just for comparison's sake, since we just finished The Hate U Give, wow, that is the worst book I've ever, ever, ever read in my life. I'm curious to see if it was a problem, because this was a little longer than our normal audio segment. We normally do about an hour, sometimes less, during the first audio segment and then about 30 minutes in the second audio segment. I think for obvious reasons, you can let me know if I was in error, if it was difficult for you to stay focused for that long. But I just don't think there's a way that you can break chapter six with what we just heard. Where would, or if you think, yes, Gus messed up, where would you have broken the audio to make that easier to digest? It wasn't a problem for me, but I have read this book many times. I will get two questions out and then we'll get to the listeners. If you would like to participate, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you would like to join the discussion, but you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.ty.cc/1race. And that is the number one. Address again, tiny.ty.cc/1race. That is the number one. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page. You will see a link for the free VOPE line. Click that link. It will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again, 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you are comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. Same procedure. If you would like to participate, you will see the dial pad on your screen. Press *61. I will see your hand. We will get you on the line. My two questions. Number one, we heard grandfather invoked. I submit grandfather's words, his dying words about yesing white people to death until they burst open and he's been a traitor all of his life. And what did he really mean? It upset everybody. Grandfather gets invoked after this sermon, this speechifying. Grandfather gets invoked. What do we make of that? Of grandfather being invoked? At this moment, is that relevant? Are his dying words about yesing white people to death relevant at this moment after we've just heard from Reverend Barbie? That would be first question. Second question, this is our second major speech by a black person in the text thus far. We had his speech after the Battle Royal, unnamed character. And that, well, I mean, hey, if we're to a major audience, we'll put it that way. Speech, second major speech from a black person to a major audience, including white people. We had the author's speech after the Battle Royal. Now we've had Barbie's speech. Comparison, contrast between these two speeches that have happened very early in the book. And that is something to keep in mind as we proceed. There are going to be quite a few. There's a lot of speechifying that goes on in this text, particularly black people giving speeches to big audiences, including whites. So pay attention to that as it goes along, and we'll compare and contrast what gets said in the speeches. But compare and contrast author's speech to what we just heard from Barbie. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have thoughts, responses to any of the questions or any other commentary, feel free, chime in. Line should be open, and I think we are going to take the remainder of the broadcast, so there should be ample time for folks to share if you have thoughts, comments, questions that you would like to share. And for sure, feedback, if it was too long, if it had difficulties, definitely feedback on that, because I don't think we've ever had an audio segment this long in the history of the Cal's Book Club, 6 years. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, Rabbi Heard.
I'll wait. Go ahead.
Mr.
No, go ahead. I didn't hear you. Which one?
Do we have a female? How about that? That'll settle it. Any females? I guess not so.
Okay, I'll take it, guys.
Right on.
Okay. first of all, greetings, Gus, and greetings to other callers. Mine should be quick. First of all, I'd like to say that the hour and a half, you know, to me, wasn't bad because the book, like you said, it doesn't separate into chapters. It goes on and on. If you break it at a certain point, you know, you're not getting the full effect of what that particular section covered. So that was a good idea on your part. And I'll start with Dr. Bledsoe. I guess you would say, you know, what is it, VGQ, you know, with him, but he's a two-timer, and he starts to scold the narrator. And one of his quotes was, he asked him, you know, what had happened to the trustee when he was driving him. And he said he had took him by to see True Blood. And I guess that angered him. And he said, well, he ordered me to take him by there. He said, he ordered you? Damn it. White folks are always giving orders. It's a habit with them. Why didn't you make an excuse? Couldn't you say they had sickness, smallpox, or picked another cabin? Why that True Blood shack? My God, boy, you black and living in the South, did you forget how to lie? And I think that that's pretty impactful on him, because he's already confused. And now someone that he looks up to is going into some mode that he don't understand. And he acts, I think he called him a nigger, you know, and he's shocked with the what this president is saying to him. And so now if you take his speech that he gave after the battle royal and then compare it to the speech of Dr. Barbie, then you got two different, I guess, modes of progress, how blacks are supposed to progress. And then one would be to be totally humble and subservient, even if it's not all the way in your mind, in your behavior. And then I guess judging from what Dr. Barbie was basically saying the same thing, but the fact that he lived a certain way spoke for itself. Because if he came up from slavery, which oddly sounded like Frederick Douglass' narratives and also Booker T. Washington's biographies. So if you put them all together, then you got this character, Dr. Barbie, who turns out to be blind. I don't know if we got there. I don't want to spoil it. But the social responsibility versus social equality. And if you look at it from the vets' standpoint, when they were back in the bar, the vets had expressed social responsibility by, I guess, fighting for the country, but then came back to no social equality. And then talking to yeah, that's Dr. Bledsoe. You know, the narrator said that for 3 years I thought of myself as a man. And here, with a few words, he's made me as helpless as an infant. Dr. Bledsoe takes away his feeling of manhood. And, you know, so I think that what all we endure, you know, in a system of white supremacy, we should, you know, be careful that we don't, you know, injure other non-white people and then cause more problems with what we're doing, because people have to respond to the system in the way that they see fit. And I mean, as deplorable as it is with Dr. Bledsoe, you know, he's expressing himself, I guess, you know, from a standpoint of profit, because let me just say this and then I'll pause and I can come back. one big difference is the founder that was speaking, I guess Dr. Barbie, his particular lifestyle, as opposed to the trustee, Mr. Norton, who was rich, and then the other trustees. It's just a totally different thing, and that's something that's worth mentioning. But I'll mute my line and give somebody else a chance, and maybe I'll come back later, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. Well wishes to your wife as well. Thank you for yielding the floor. Jay in St. Louis, feel free.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the comments. And I think this book is amazing. I just want to say that off the, you know, from the beginning, this book is amazing. I took down a couple of notes. Before Dr. Bledsoe's speech starts, I think the narrator, he was talking about how, you know, how he really felt deep inside that this school meant a lot to him. He didn't want to be taken away, and he was really silenced once he came in and Dr. Bledsoe was yelling at him and all of that stuff. So he thought that his moral virtue really mattered, and I felt like he swallowed the moral discourse that white paternalism brings with it. It kind of reminded me of like the civilizing mission of the colonial times. It's like he swallowed that whole, like, you know, if I really believe in the white God, and that association between whiteness and, you know, cosmic judgment was definitely there as he was approaching the chapel. So, you know, he felt like I got the message that he felt like if he internalized it, then certainly there would be some type of payoff for it. He talked about the mask. I think one character actually said, or he actually described someone as changing their face and like putting on a mask. And it reminded me of Paul Lawrence Dunbar's poem. He described Dr. Bledsoe as grandmotherly when he was approaching Mr. Norton. And I thought he kept calling Mr. Norton the founder. And I kept thinking how that word is connected to like the creator. So I was thinking about that. But Dr. Bledsoe, even though he's clearly a male, him being feminized in an instant like that, it made me think of the feminization of black males under these type of conditions. And really the kind of spurious nature of black male patriarchy or black male domination, you know, when white people are just in charge and black men can be just cut down in any moment. Once Dr. Bledsoe got into his speech, I think that was another good example of how all of these black characters in this book, even though they make mistakes and they do bad things or things we wouldn't agree with, they all are very complex. They're all humans. They're full of contradictions, and they're all insightful and useful to the character and to the reader and understanding things. I think this entire book is really the author's confrontation with death. I like reading black literature as like political philosophy, and man, just his you know, through Dr. Bledsoe, his confrontation with the death of slavery, with the tyranny of white supremacy, and just confronting the death that comes with rebelling white rule in any form. That was refreshing, very refreshing. And let me see. And it made me think that we've been here before, because a lot of the, like when he was describing the leader that led the people before the leader was killed, in this story Dr. Bledsoe was giving, I'm thinking of Nat Turner, Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Huey Newton, Martin Luther King, all of these people. I just think we've been here before in these different instances, these different historical moments. And I just thought it gave me a lot to think about, and I'll shut my mouth. Thanks for letting me speak.
Indeed, much to think about. Interestingly, one of the times in the chapter we just heard, chapter 5, where he uses the term masks and talking about people wearing masks. He's talking about white people. Paul Laurence Dunbar, in his poem, We Wear the Mask, he's talking about black people having to conceal our feelings because of white supremacy racism. But Ellison, he writes, talking about white people, the white founders at this historically black college, he says, give you the, it's such a long sentence, but wow, he says, here upon this stage, the black rite of Horatio Alger was performed to God's own acting script, with millionaires come down to portray themselves, not merely acting out the myth of their goodness and wealth and success and power and benevolence and authority in cardboard masks, but themselves, these virtues concretely. And he goes on to give a hugely powerful metaphor, comparing them to Jesus Christ, not in the wafer and wine, but the flesh and blood, the religion of white supremacy. But yeah, that he's whites wearing cardboard masks. What the brilliance of Ralph Ellison. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. This is, hello everyone, and this is Red in Nevada. Couple of notes that I took, and hopefully I'm not getting ahead of myself, because I did go ahead and get the Kindle version of the book, and I thought it was interesting how you can see, like, where other people, there was one passage, and it might have been, like, from chapter 4, but it said, like, over 188 people had highlighted that passage. But then I also got the audiobook too, and I definitely agree that Joe Morton, it's hard to like stop it, because I just really get so enveloped in the book, and especially his voices and how he changes them. But the first highlight that I had, it was the sentence where, like, early in chapter 5, it says, loved as the defeated come to love the symbols of their conquerors. And I thought that was interesting. Sorry, I'm driving. I'll try to make this quick. I thought that it was also interesting how it's like when he was describing the pastor. I can't remember if they said it was pastor or reverend. Barbie, the first thing that he referenced was, you know, a man of striking ugliness. And we don't really get that when he describes Norton. And even when he talks about his hair being white, it's like cotton hair, and the implications of, you know, it's unruly. But with Mr. Norton, you know, it was silken white hair, likening him to Saint Nicholas. Just thinking about, like, some of the things that Gus had pointed out before, how the terms white and, or white and black are used in one of the passages. It says, and your parents followed this remarkable man across the black sea of prejudice. And I thought that that's kind of like a contradiction, because I don't know the whole black sea of prejudice. It makes me think more along the lines of, you know, how people may think, well, anti-blackness is worse than white supremacy. So that's what came to mind with that. I really appreciate it. I kind of like the conversation between the Invisible Man and Dr. Bledsoe, especially with the fact where it's like, you know, well, you're in the South. You don't know when you're supposed to lie to white people. That's essentially what they want. And I don't think that, you know, that's something that definitely I would feel like is worldwide. And I like that. I've been thinking about the question that was posed like a couple of weeks ago, maybe when we started the book, was why would white people like this? And I feel like maybe it's the, you know, Mr. Ellison's really eloquent way of maybe showing them one thing, like in the book, maybe describing to them one thing, you know, all the different, I guess, like correlations between white and goodness, but then, you know, we could still maybe, like, with maybe less confused black people, we can see the transformation of, you know, you worship white, and you could kind of see as the Invisible Man in, during his collegiate years, you know, this full-on worship of whiteness. And then, but in the beginning of the book, like Emmy had mentioned before, you know, how that didn't mean anything, that you're still, you know, you're still going to be a victim, you're, no matter what you do. I'll mute myself right now, and then I might come back in if I have some more time. Thank you.
For sure. Drive safely. When later on, if you are able and safe, I would be interested, because I've read some of the Kindle books for our book club before, and that is interesting to see what gets highlighted. I know I read the Kindle version of Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It. I read the Kindle version of Katrina After the Flood, and it was very interesting. I remember that many of the things that I thought were significant in those books did not get highlighted by, like, you know, 800 other readers. They would highlight, you know, little goofy thing, things that I thought were very trivial. But yeah, I would be curious to hear what got highlighted by so many people in chapter four. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you'd like to share, line should be open. Proceed. Well, while folks are hanging out, I guess getting their notes together or other thoughts, certainly if we have responses to the questions that were asked, I have notes, and I think we even have some people who wrote commentary in that I will read as well, but I will share a few of the notes that I took from the chapter four and chapter five, where he says at the beginning, here within this quiet greenness, I possessed the only identity I had ever known, and I was losing it. That, I think, is huge in the system of racism, white supremacy, in on so many levels. I think racists, part of being a zombie, an automaton, not thinking, not using logic for yourself. Racists, they assign roles to you. That is the niggerization. This is the type of nigger you will be on the plantation. And they give you this role. Oh, okay, so you're going to be a college student here. We'll give you a scholarship, nigger, so you can go off to our school and, you know, we will educate you in terms of how we want you to function on the plantation. And then we can take that away like instantaneously. And it's, oh my goodness, now what am I going to do? Everything is being taken from my entire identity in terms of who I am. I mean, you hear the sense of dread. How will I go home? What will I do? How will I face my family? Like, I think so. 2018, I think there are tons of black people who feel very similarly and in many other regards in terms of how the system of white supremacy gives you your identity. If I don't have this job, or if I don't have, I mean, it can be lots of things. It can sometimes be real trivial. If I don't have, you know, the latest iPhone, or if I don't have, you know, whatever the latest gadget is, then, you know, somehow my identity is in question. That the system of white supremacy is so powerful. Let's see. This section, anti-blackness. I think this is so important. This has been a major theme, because pretty much every time he talks about black people, it's with contempt, disdain. The narrator I'm talking about, like, I think last week, it might have been Jay that pointed out the metaphor when he saw the black vets from the Golden Day, that he used the metaphor comparing them to a chain gang, to prisoners. And when the battle royal at the beginning, the contempt that he had for the other black boys that were there, and just being disgusted that he had to be thrown in with them when he just wanted to give his speech to the good whites. This contempt that he presents when talking to Mr. Norton, he says, wow, I wanted to stop the car and talk with Mr. Norton to beg his pardon for what
he had seen to plead and show him tears, unashamed tears like those of a child before his parent. What a metaphor, keeping in mind of why Mr. Fuller says black people do not qualify as men and women, white man, white woman, black males and females. To denounce all we'd seen and heard, to assure him that far from being like any of the people we had seen, I hated them, that I believed in the principles of the founder with all my heart and soul, and that I believed in his own goodness and kindness in extending the hand of his benevolence to helping us poor, ignorant people out of the mire and darkness. Brilliance, in my view, of Ella. I mean, wow, that is brain trashing in the system of white supremacy and the contempt. That's what the system conditions black people. That's how it conditions us to think about black people. That's why Dr. Welsing talked about black self-respect so frequently. The system cannot function unless black people think like this. When we see ourselves, when we see other black people, just total contempt. Every time something that I think one of our callers was talking about, they're bringing Martin back on television, just anything to promote nastiness and vileness. When we see other black people and blaming black people for the condition that they're in, it's not the system of white supremacy. It's that you black people are just lazy and ignorant and you don't want to come to the college and learn. And yeah, and I totally believe you, white man. Totally, like, amazing passage in the book, I think, making a tremendous point about the system. And it does it again with the descriptions. Every time he describes a black person, I think you all touched on that when talking about the caller was talking about Dr. Barbie, but when he talks about Dr. Bledsoe, he says, I visualize Dr. Bledsoe with his broad globular face, the language of Mr. Ellison, with his broad globular face that seemed to take its form from the fat pressing from the inside, which, as air pressing against the membrane of a balloon, gave it a shape and buoyancy. Old Buckethead, some of the fellows called him. I mean, just the total disdain that you do not hear. We've not heard that thus far with regards to any of the white characters, I don't think. I don't think we even heard this level of disdain for any of the whites at the Battle Royal when they were throwing them on the electric wire and kicking them and everything, like, reserved for black people. And that is consistent within the system of racism, white supremacy. And even the passage that comes down, think Jay in St. Louis, to his point that we maybe have had this frequently in the system of white supremacy, like you have lots of repetition in terms of our responses and types of things that you can expect to happen as long as the system exists. This book was published in 1952. He says, talking of Dr. Bledsoe, I hope to be influential with wealthy men all over the country, consulted in matters concerning the race, a leader of his people, the possessor of not one but two Cadillacs, and he has two in parentheses, a good salary, and a soft, good-looking, and creamy-complexioned wife. Black get back. That's the way I take creamy most of the time. When I think creamy, I think white. If I'm incorrect in that, you can let me know. But that sounds like a wife that doesn't have too much melanin. She is non-white, but definitely black get back, brown stick around, yellow mellow, white right. Continuing, I thought the section where he's talking about Dr. Bledsoe, particularly the way that he's described him, old Buckethead and his globular face, like all of these really intense details about his blackness and his ugliness and his bigness. He comes back and he says, when he sees Mr. Norton, Dr. Bledsoe, when he sees Mr. Norton with his injury after the ride and everything, and he says, suddenly he rushed forward. Mr. Norton, your head, he cried, a strange grandmotherly concern in his voice. I think to Jay in St. Louis's point about the in fact, might even be a demonstration of one interpretation of grandfather's words about yesing them to death. You will hear a lot more from Dr. Bledsoe next week, but could be a great demonstration, illustration of yesing them to death and showing all of this concern and going over with giving a brilliant performance
But understanding, you know, hey, I am just performing. Just put a pin in that for next week. This could be, Dr. Bledsoe could be doing exactly what Grandpa laid out on his deathbed. But you might need to hear chapter six to process all that together. Or maybe you can put it together now, but I think after next week, you'll have a lot more detail to work with. Let me double check. I have more notes. I'm just trying to double check to make sure that I generally try to let people speak before I give my notes. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we've not heard from you at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Hello, may I speak?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, this is Irie in New Orleans. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, host. What was I going to say? The comment that he made about his wife being cream colored, there was actually a podcast called Champagne Shark where they had a similar discussion about our image as far as skin tone, alluding to our edibility to white people. We're not like beautiful people. We're sensual. We stimulate the senses, and they do a lot of association, and so do we, comparing our skin tone to food. And so a lot of like the cream colored coffee, caramel, those are things that are more delectable in the eyes of white supremacists. And also I wanted to mention to you really quick, there is a book by Mr. Ellison called Flying Home. I read it in high school. And it's a collection of short stories. And there's one in particular I remember where it he's narrating about a lynching, being a young white boy going to a lynching with either a grandfather or a father. And reading that short story was the first time that I found out that people actually dismembered the black men and their genitalia, took them home and sold it and kept it, and it blew my mind. And I knew after reading that book I wasn't quite ready to read Invisible Man, so I thank you for hosting your series with it now. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Much obliged. Folks can check out Flying Home. I'm sure that's great. If it's short stories, those should be quick reads. I mean, you can just flip through randomly and read one whenever you feel like it. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Thanks for taking my call. I've been thinking about your question about why whites were celebrating this book. And I think one thing that I thought of was there are a lot of references to white literature in the book in terms of Emerson and other aspects of white literature. And I think that may be one of the reasons why Edgar Allan Poe, Reverend Barbie's name is Homer. That may be a reference to the Homer, the Greek author, in terms of the Odyssey. I don't know, but that's what kind of struck me in terms of answer your question. One thing that struck me about the book was Mr. Norton, I think, was characteristic of hypocrisy, because he had a lot of power in this situation to intervene with the narrator. And I'm suspicious of all his feigning of illness. I mean, they were carrying him around up and down stairs, and it just seems like he could have intervened for the narrator and really told Dr. Bledsoe, don't take this out on him. And I think he wanted to have to play both sides of the fence. Well, I did the best I can. But he had tremendous power. I mean, the black people were all victims in this situation and under his aegis and power, and he could have intervened easily to have saved them. What struck me about the chapter, what was interesting, I thought, it took me a couple of times to read through the chapter twice, where he was talking about with Reverend Barbie, was I had to kind of think about the fact that this is a person, the narrator, who's looking back on his life and interpreting his feelings retrospectively. And then it kind of sort of made sense to me, because in that respect, he may have a lot of ambivalence. You know, this is everything that he wanted to do in life. He really respected Reverend Bledsoe. This is his ideal situation. But he knows at the end, it's just not going to happen for him. He's going to be rejected. So I don't know. I thought that was interesting for me. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Thank you for answering the question. Great insight about the white literature references. Other listeners that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed. We miss any folks, other folks still spectating or getting their notes together?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Emmy.
Greetings. I'm kind of running around. I do have notes, but I don't have the notes on me. I'm in a store, but I haven't spoken, and I wanted to say I lose a little bit before I lose all opportunity to speak. I feel as though I've missed out a little bit, because the portion of the reading that we covered, I didn't get to hear the narration of it. And so I just read it and then jumped in when I got out of work. And I feel that I've just completely missed out on the beauty of what this part would have been if I had heard it. So I will go back and listen, because I think, as many other people have voiced, that the narrator is absolutely fantastic and does an amazing job. And one thing I thought that's completely not necessarily about the top, this section of this week's section of the reading, but it's that I have no children, but if I did, this would be a book that I would play, even though I knew they wouldn't be able to understand any of it. But even as little children, it would just be because of how greatly it's narrated. Well, how wonderfully it's written, and then how wonderfully it's narrated. And the two together could help young people really develop an appreciation for the written word, and then when it's read, narrating it. All of that aside, you know, for me, it's important to critique myself. And I think that I can use things as mirrors to analyze whether or not, you know, something is constructive or non-constructive, or if I can see myself or that, or see that in me, or how can I necessarily relate to it. And I feel as though I relate to the invisible man in many, many ways. And in this particular part of the reading, again, I have more notes, but one that I remember writing down was when the invisible man says, you know, why are they acting like this in front of white people? And in front of this white man in specific, I think Mr. Norton it was specifically. But the behavior switching part, or however it's framed, I'm not sure how to best phrase it, but I find that fascinating, that even in all of my life that I've spent, you know, searching and seeking, I still could feel that way. I could still understand that. you know. And so the programming being so deeply ingrained, I understand why the narrator, like the narrator, the protagonist in the story speaks with such emotion, it's so deeply felt. I also thought it was very interesting, the conversation that Dr. Bledsoe, if I'm saying the name correctly, he said, you don't know what to do. You don't know how to be in front of these white people. You know, and I thought the same thing. Like, yeah, but you mean you don't know, you know? Of course, also the counter argument to that is, well, he's a white person, he said do something, so I do it because he's white and I haven't, you know, practiced being able to lie or whatever it is, because he doesn't seem very good at that so far in the story. He, you know, he's not sharing a lot of stories where he's had to lie, so to speak. So I thought that was an interesting moment, because that would seem like that's what it would sound like. Like when Dr. Welsing would say, you know, what are white people talking about when non-white people, specifically black people, are not around? What are they talking about? It seems like that's our conversation. What are we talking about when they're not around? You know what I'm saying? To some extent, you know, not the nonsense stuff, but, you know, when it comes to racism, white supremacy, but you don't know how to act or what to do. So I thought that was interesting. I also, I've picked up on a lot of the judgments and the way that the narrator speaks about black people in just a really bad light. But the one that stuck out to me was when the girl was like, can you tell my boyfriend my coat, like the grass is green, you know? And he immediately just assumed whatever, she'll be pregnant and out of here and whatever, and however much time. Again, I have a note for it, so I'm paraphrasing. But I was like, man, who's to say that that's what, you know, the grass is green means, or that just because the grass is green and we meet where the grass is green that I'm going to just be pregnant next week or something, you know? So that whole self-elevation and judgment of people just is, I think, is fascinating, primarily because the story is written in retrospect. So, you know, he goes, obviously, he makes a complete 180-degree turn or some other way to phrase it, you know, from being this person who's so excited and eager to amount to something and be somebody to I'm not even seen. So I think it's just very interesting. And also when he said this such and such is just going to be a farmer, and I thought being a farmer used to be an admirable thing, you know, but the context is just very interesting, and how it's written is superb and narrated equally as well. So if there's time later, I guess I can give some of my more specific comments, but I'm enjoying the mirror that this book is, for me at least. And maybe I'll get to chime in a little bit. Thank you for listening.
Indeed, indeed. Really outstanding work, Ralph Ellison. Other folks that we missed completely, any other folks have a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Soon folks are all right for the time being. We did have quite a few folks who wrote commentary in, so I'm going to try and get some of their comments. This is Rob in Wisconsin. He said, listening to the archive of Friday night's book study session, great hearing Star Wars, great ear hearing Star Wars theme in the background. I've read Invisible Man before. I was confused and a little frustrated after I completed the reading, so last night's study session brought some clarity to some parts that I was confused about. To answer the question proposed, yes, I absolutely agree that this text supports the theme of the black male rapist. I was very confused about the rape dream scene and the scene placed inside the Golden Day bar. I suspect that it may be many other black people left with that confusion. I picked up this text because it's popular, so I'm listening with a different ear at this point and picking up a lot more from the text. Definitely a book that I think you learn more each time you read it, like a good movie. You can watch it, read it multiple times, and you will learn more and even appreciate the text more, I think. We had another person wrote in I think I could listen to The Invisible Man over and over again. Every time I engage in this book, I learn something new. I thought the contrast that was made between the Battle Royal scene and the Golden Day scene was interesting. The Battle Royal scene involved rich, powerful white men that were able to exercise their power along with a white woman that was a symbol of perfection, while the Golden Day involved broken black males that were supposed to be in higher positions than the average black male but were damaged by racism. The black females are also viewed as prostitutes instead of a symbol of perfection. Also, one of the major lessons that I picked up from this book the first time I read it was the value of a piece of paper. I, too, was confused like the main character and thought that the chase for pieces of paper would solidify me as a leader and it would allow me to help others. I thought the more papers I could accumulate, the more I could help uplift younger black people. It wasn't until I started seeing black male principals and administrators escorted out of school buildings, never to return again, did I really begin to understand the value of a piece of paper. In fact, the job I currently work in now was looking for a black male of African descent in order to replace an unruly black male assistant superintendent. That is how I got hired. That is the true value of a piece of paper. That is a major motif in the book that is going to come up again and again and again. Pieces of paper. Black people chasing pieces of paper. Next week, in fact, we have other folks that checked in, that wrote in. I'm just checking. Other folks who dialed in. Anybody that we missed who dialed in with a hand up have comments, questions? Grant, I'll check in again, and then I'll check and see if any of the other folks have any extra comments that they would like to share. Some of the other notes that I have, I thought it was, again, revealing of the conditioning in the system of white supremacy that, and I think we've even talked about this a lot in workplace racism, in many different capacities where non-white people will be more vicious or unruly towards other black people in these environments, even sometimes than whites, as they might have been trained or told to do so. But the passage where Dr. Bledsoe, he's talking to Mr. Norton, and Mr. Norton's like, oh, you know, it wasn't this young guy's fault. He didn't do anything. And Dr. Bledsoe responds, he says, don't be kind, sir. Dr. Bledsoe said, you can't be soft with these people. We mustn't pamper them. Like that sort of paternalistic attitude, you hear that frequently from black people, I think, who are hoping to earn some sort of favor with whites or to show them, yes, this I understand. This is the way that we should approach things. I know exactly the way that you want us to think. I got it. I believe it fervently. I believe it more than you do. And boop, I'm willing to go out and put it into practice publicly. Anytime I think we've seen examples of that, that is victimization. That is brain trashing. That is the conditioning of racism, white supremacy in the making of niggers. The passage I think that Emmy mentioned about the vet, she says he had no right to talk to a white man as he had, not with me to take the punishment. I think I've heard that from others as well, expressing frustration with other victims who have not been conditioned, or the conditioning did not work as well, or they are rejecting their programming and not functioning in a way that would please whites, asking questions, no less. I think the vet did ask a lot of questions of Mr. Norton. Some of the notes that I had from chapter 5, the section he says, the crude preachers most of us knew in our hometowns and of whom we were deeply ashamed. Again, that sense of shame and humiliation with other black people. These logical appeals, which reached us more like the thrust of a firm and formal design requiring nothing more than the lucidity of uncluttered periods, the lulling movement of multisyllabic words to thrill and console us. Again, the eloquence in his writing, but talking about
the verbiage that they're getting at school when they go to chapel, that this is, it's so logical and structured. And it seems like they're just getting information so that they can behave for whites. That's what the vet thinks. And I think we'll see more on that as we go. But yeah, the type of preaching, speechifying that's being given to them, it might sound nice, the verbal technology of our conquest, as Armand says, but in terms of substance, what are you actually getting? Continuing, I said something about the creators of the campus, the whites, Norton being referenced as gods, already talked about that. I thought it was especially important when he says, but the words of the others were stronger than the strength of philanthropic dollars, deeper than the shafts sunk in the earth for oil and gold, more awe-inspiring than the miracles fabricated in scientific laboratories, for their most innocent words were acts of violence to which we of the campus were hypersensitive, though we endured them not. I had to think about that one several times. I think Jay in St. Louis said, gives you a lot to think about. And that was one that I had to think about, even though understanding their innocent words were acts of violence. I certainly understand that with whites and folks like Mr. Norton. I think he even, you know, had a few of those moments in the car in terms of his words being acts of violence, white supremacy. But we being of the campus were hypersensitive, though we endured them not. Still processing on the rest of that passage. Oh my goodness. To Emmy's point, this will be my last one, and then if other folks have commentary, I will hush. But the section where he says, I too touched a white man today. This is where he's talking about Dr. Bledsoe going and greeting the founders, the white founders at the college. He says, I too had touched a white man today, and I felt that it had been disastrous, and I realized then that he was the only one of us whom I knew, except perhaps a barber or a nursemaid, who could touch a white man with impunity. And I remembered, too, that whenever white guests came upon the platform, he placed his hand upon them as though exercising a powerful magic. I watched his teeth flash as he took a white hand, then, with all seated, he went to his place at the end of the row of chairs. Again, the brilliance of his writing, but just again, this constant sense of trepidation with whites saying the wrong thing. He has the moment in the car where he gets so nervous, I think for belching, and he almost runs off the road and has to apologize. Like, he has so much fear in dealing with whites. And I think that is a lot of us just dealing with being intimidated with whites, and or whether it's on the job or in a variety of different circumstances, just touching a white person can be disastrous. Indeed. Context of white supremacy. Did other folks have commentary they wanted to share?
Can I be heard? Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I missed in your questions the passage, your reference to the grandfather. I didn't, I guess when I, in my reading, I just wanted you to maybe point that out, what the passage you were talking about.
It's, for me, it's the very end of chapter 5. I have the ebook, so I can't give a page, but it's the very last page of chapter 5, or right at the end, when he's talking about the song, Dvorak's New World Symphony, and I kept hearing Swing Low, yeah, Sweet Chariot resounding through its dominant theme, my mother's and grandfather's favorite spiritual. That's where grandfather is invoked at the end of the chapter. And my question to that was, since grandfather has been invoked, does that relate at all to what we heard from Barbie, grandfather's invocation of, yes, I'm to death. I was a traitor. Yes, I'm to death. until they burst right open. Does that have any relevance to what we heard from Barbie?
Well, I'll have to review that again and think about it. The other question I had was, again, even though white people were very celebratory of the book, it seems at the time that a lot of black people were very negative on it. And that's something I'm trying to understand. I don't know, maybe Gus, you have a better insight into that, but that's something I'm trying to think about as I go through it. You know, maybe it was too honest and too accurate, but that's just a question I have. Maybe I'm misinterpreting the thoughts of people at the time, but my sense was that he was celebrated a lot among white people, but received a lot of criticism from black people from the book with regards to the book. But I'd appreciate your thoughts on that.
I know Professor Lena Hill, she is an expert on Ellison. Gusty is not. But Lena Hill, she is a biographer. She's written about Ellison extensively. She's a black female professor at Iowa, at a major university in Iowa. She has written about Ellison. She's written about Invisible Man specifically. And that's what we talked about. She was a guest on the program. I played an audio clip of her last week. And she talked about when she was a guest on the program, exactly what she said, that at the time, many black people were not pleased with Ellison. They were, a lot of black people were not necessarily excited about this book and were not pleased with Ellison. They wanted him to be more vocal, more quote unquote militant, perhaps, on issues dealing with racism that might even be consistent with black writers who get a lot of attention from white readers being thought of as not being militant by some black people. That seems like it maybe could be a pattern, but I will have to go back and re-listen to the audio because she talks about that, some of the details in terms of black readers, black people in general, not being as pleased, not being enamored with him at that time, the 1950s, 1960s.
Thank you. I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, or I guess Ivy, you're with us if you have commentary.
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers on the line. For the gentleman who just spoke, I think it sounded to me like he was recalling that black people weren't fans of the book initially. And if he recalls that, what may help him is if he thinks back to, you know, what it is that they said, what the exact criticism that they had, what they were, and that might help them to know why they didn't like the book. But I wanted to say, Gus, when I listened to the program on Black Talk Radio, for the first 30 minutes, maybe sometimes a little longer, it's the sound is fine, and then it becomes very, very choppy, and that's whether I listen to it on my computer or if I listen to it on my phone. And I know of other people who have said the same thing a while back, or maybe a few weeks back or so, but I don't know about now. And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Oh. Okay, and so, you know, about something that you said about how he wanted to prove to him that I think it might have been, I don't know if it was the chauffeur or someone on the campus, they wanted to prove to Mr. Norton that he wasn't like the rest of the black people, and it just struck me as, you know, where you want to prove this to him. It strikes me as this mentality where, you know, if we act a certain way, white people won't practice racism, and that it seemed to me that that's how he relates to white people in general for that reason, just to, I guess, not be mistreated, understanding that, but not understanding that that has nothing to do with nothing, that if this was about behavior, white people would be the most terrorized group on the planet. And you think about, you know, Dr. King, he was a preacher who was wearing a suit and preaching nonviolence, and he got shot in the throat. So, I mean, another thing also is that the way that, the way that so many people related to Mr. Norton, I mean, it is so nauseating. Like, they're just falling all over this male, you know, when he's sick or whatever. I mean, just they're just the way that they're coming to his aid, like they're like they're the ambulance, and like it's like they're standing in line to give him mouth to mouth resuscitation. I mean, it's just disgusting to me. And like when I don't know if it was the chauffeur or the student, you know, on the campus, or if that's the same person, but when they were leaving for chapel to see this Mr. Bledsoe, he said, I'm not going to get his exact word correct, but it was something along these lines. He said something about, you know, a distinguished white man and silken hair and all of this. And the way that he spoke about him, it was like he was worshiping him because he was white, and only because he was white. I mean, it was just, and just marveling at him because he was white. And it reminded me of the racism you get, I mean, the hate you give, where they were talking about a pixie cut and perfect hair, and even the way that the race soldier Chris was being described. The way that he talked about Mr. Norton, it was almost homoerotic, but it wasn't. It was clearly just worship and marvel and awe at this man because he's white. And then later on in the book and in this section, a statement was made about, you know, I too touched a white man, and something about touching white people with impunity, and like you know you can't do that. I mean, it's just, as I said, it just was absolutely nauseating. And that's all I had. And thanks, Gus. Thanks, everyone. I'll mute my line.
Though nauseating, do you, I guess, with the danger that I think that he's getting at, with that touching a white person had been disastrous, do you see any authenticity in that?
Oh, absolutely. As far as that particular part, I think I didn't see that particular part as talking about the touching a white man with impunity. I didn't see that as worship or anything at all. I thought that was just stating a fact about, you know, the consequences because of how things were set up, and we couldn't even look them in the eye and all of that. There were consequences behind that. Just that whole, that type of setup right there is what breeds this type of mentality. And what came to my mind is the things that I did say were nauseating, the way he was described and his silken hair and all of that. I wondered, did some black people see white people this way? And if so, do some black people today see white people this way? It's just, there's just not words. It's so bad. It's so disgusting. And it's like, to worship these people because they have money, because they have power. And the thing about that is that they did not get that from any type of merit of their own. They didn't get that because they're so innately intelligent or any of that. They got that from raping and pillaging and murdering and terrorizing everyone that they say is non-white. And to worship these people for having all these things that they got by such disgusting means is just so, it's irritating, it's infuriating, it's saddening. And when I talk about it being nauseating, I'm not blaming victims at all. I feel sorry for us to view these terrorists the way that we do. And so, yeah, that was it. Did I answer your question, Gus?
Yes, ma'am. Question answered. Yeah, I appreciate the explanation. I think the only thing I would say is I think the danger that whites represent, I think, is directly related to that. Well, certainly the religion of white supremacy, that right there, we are conditioned, trained to worship white Jesus, whites in general. But when you are terrorized, I think a response to that, like Dr. Welsing, when she always talks about Stockholm syndrome, like, man, when you have people, when you're in a weak position that can harm you, take your life, your entire family's life, like widespread murder, raping, pillaging, as you said, I think for a lot of black people, they just say, hey, this is the way that I can protect myself. I will do what these white people say and worship them and show that as often as I can. That is nauseating. But, you know, that, man, that is about the only defense that many victims of racism, white supremacy have been able to find, unfortunately. Trying to solve this problem as best we can. Any other folks that we...
Can I respond real quick?
Give me 1 second. Make sure we don't have any folks that I have missed totally. Actually, Jay in St. Louis yielded the floor. Did you want to go ahead and comment, sir?
Just real quickly, I wanted to throw in that the write-in note from Robin, Wisconsin, I really empathize with that position. I really empathize with this main character and this type of swallowing, you know, being victim to thinking that paper matters and, you know, these appointments that white people give us. I wanted to just point out British indirect rule. It was a common thing when they go to these native people's lands. This was practiced in India, parts of Asia as well, in Africa. But what you do is you find a tribe leader, you appoint a leader, you give them a name, a spiffy house, and a nice car. You appoint them, and then you have them carry out the colonial rule. And through their dependents, you can compel them. So I think that's showing itself in his book. And as you said, it might show next week. I also thought about, again, the leader. I think it was Reverend Barbie or Dr. Bledsoe. One of the two, they were giving a sermon. And they talked about the man, the leader, who led his people out of the land, you know, out of this terrible land of tyranny and to the freedom of rebellion. And I felt like the form that story took, it reminded me of the quip from COINTELPRO about, you know, the black messiah, the black leader rising up from the ghetto. And it's scary to think about, you know, with that repetition that we pointed out earlier. And you mentioned the trepidation, Gus, but I thought about when he said he was anticipating punishment after bringing Mr. Norton back. He was so nervous, his it blurred his vision. And I was like, wow, I can't imagine. Well, I can, but it's just like, wow, you know, that's some serious, serious terrorism. And it's just important to reflect on the violent conflict that is underneath relations between black and white people. And that's all I'll say. Thanks for letting me speak again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you use the term colonialism, it reminded me of earlier eras in the system of white supremacy. Mr. Norton certainly reminds me of Rudyard Kipling's White Man's Burden. I don't know if Mr. Kipling will be mentioned in this book. We talked about white literature references in the text, but White Man's Burden, Mr. Norton, right on cue. Do we have any folks that we missed completely who had a hand up that did not get to share at all?
May I be heard? I don't know if anybody else if nobody else speaks up. This is Red in Nevada.
We can hear you.
I'll
yes.
wait a few moments. Oh, did you want me to wait?
Proceed.
Okay. Thank you so much. I finally got to a safe place. So, or quote unquote safe. So the quote, it was actually in chapter 4 had it, and now I can't find it. So just while I'm looking for that, the other things that I wanted to mention was the part where the Invisible Man, he had said, he had asked Mr. Norton right before he was going to leave, well, you know, can I take you, you know, to wherever you need to go? And Mr. Norton was like, well, no, I don't need the machine. And I thought, I guess I was thinking about it with the sense of thinking about like that vet doctor from the Golden Day, how he was saying that the Invisible Man, who's basically autonomous. And I kind of correlated it with that, like, you know, Mr. Norton in a really covert racist way said, no, I'm not going to, you're a machine and I won't need you. You're replaceable. So that's what I thought about that. Or maybe I'm sounding crazy or whatever. The casket part, when they were talking about the founder dying and, you know, this last bit of light was then, you know, shut when the casket was, you know, shut. And basically, you know, the only way that Black people can be, and like other callers have alluded to, but more along the lines of the skin complexion, I think it was the lady from New Orleans, but how they can only be good if the founder was being described in a good way as far as being light. And even his death, you know, there are clouds of coming, you know, shut out all the light and, you know, luminous and everything like that. So I thought that was interesting. But I did find the passage where it said, 892 other people highlighted this part. It's back in chapter 4, and it is, I think it was the doctor, if I'm not mistaken, it's when the doctor was speaking, but it says, already he's learned to repress not only his emotions, but his humanity. He's invisible, a walking personification of the negative, the most perfect achievement of your dream, sir, the mechanical man. So basically what I was just talking about. So, but yeah, that was the part where the doctor was yelling at Mr. Norton, the racist. And I do definitely agree with the first part of the whole touching white people being disastrous, but then it kind of goes off into more white worship. Well, yes, it's disastrous, but you know, you can touch them only if you're there to help them. And I'll mute my line there. Thank you for allowing me to share again.
For sure. Thank you for finding that passage. Interesting. Interesting. Ivy, did you want to get your response in? Thank you for your patience.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, thank you for that insight, because I never even thought about that part of, I guess, speaking about white people in these worship sort of terms is not just, you know, genuine worship, but sometimes just a survival tactic. And also wanted to thank Jay from St. Louis for yielding the floor and tell you that I always appreciate your commentary. Like, you speak like a reviewer, like a professional reviewer, and it's just and also the way that you, something about the way that you see the things that you read, like when you talked about The Hate You Give and the way that you describe the things in this particular book, you actually remind me of how the author of this book, how he writes. You sort of speak and give your reviews in the same way that he writes, in that very poetic, very thought-provoking and very constructive and kind of deep way of the way that you talk about the things that you read. So I really appreciate your input every time. And that's it. I'm in my line. Thanks, Gus.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. Context of white.
Gus, can I just say thanks?
Oh, for sure.
Can I just say thanks? Yeah. I'm very, very humble. I'm just, you know, appreciative to, you know, be speaking with somebody who's listening. So I'm very, very humbled. Thank you. That's all I want to say. Thanks, guys.
Yes, sir.
Context of white supremacy. We have less than 10 minutes left. So if you have a question, comment, gripe, anything that you want to make sure you get in. We have about 8 minutes left in the broadcast. And thank you, Ivy, for letting me know about the tech issue. We'll see if we can get to the root of what's causing the interference. But thank you for the heads up. Any other comments, questions folks need to get in before we finish up? Anything else stand out about the text?
Yes, ma'am. I'll be heard.
Mr. Demery Four.
Yes. To your earlier question, the grandfather's dying words, teach it to the young'uns, is directly related to the doctor speaking before the young congregation at the college. So he's teaching that concept to the young'uns. But I think Mr. Norton was, you know, he's like a pivotal character because he's the ideal racist. He thanks the narrator for his contribution to his faith, not the faith of the little young Negro. You know, thank you for your contribution to my faith. And the book mentioned whites' familiarity with their unfamiliarities. And like you mentioned earlier, innocent words were acts of violence. And a lot of references, Dr. Bledsoe being called cold black daddy, a lot of references, father references. And then it's odd that the author mentions his grandfather, but not his actual father. There was one reference to his father, but just briefly. And I thought it was interesting when they described the thin singer with the large uplifted eyes. And if you see any portraits of like Marian Anderson or Mahalia Jackson or whatever back, those gospel singers, it seems their eyes are always uplifted, like it's looking into the sky. And then there was one last thing. Can't find it now. So what? Yeah, Dr. Bledsoe created a double standard when, you know, he's talking to him and he's saying, nigga, this isn't the time to lie. I'm no white man. And so
too far ahead.
Oh, that's too far ahead. Okay. All right. Well, I'll mute my line.
Chapter six is next week. We will be ready to roll. Mr. Demery Four is already ready to roll for next Friday, chapter six. And I said, Dr. Bledsoe, man, oh man. Yes, we will have lots more to say about Dr. Bledsoe and whether or not grandfather's logic would apply to him as well. But yes, we'll be ready to roll for next Friday. Anybody else have commentary they wanted to get in before we wrap up?
May I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy.
Okay. When something is the truth, you see it everywhere. And I have tremendous respect for Mr. Fuller's work. And I'm reading like a PDF version, so I can't really tell pages or anything like that. But it's at the beginning of one of the speeches. And the person speaking, I don't remember the name or whatever, says, I'm sure you've heard it many times. Recall how he came upon his initial learning through shrewd questioning of his little masters, the elders' masters never suspecting, and how he learned his alphabet and taught himself to read and solve the secret of words, going instinctively to the Holy Bible with its great wisdom for his first knowledge. But it's the questioning that made me highlight that passage. And there's other things to say, but we're running short on time, but I did want to say that because Mr. Fuller always talks about questioning, and who knows, maybe Mr. Fuller read this book, but even still, questions solve problems, or asking questions can help us solve problems. So I thought that was pretty cool when I saw his shrewd questioning is what allowed him to learn. So thank you all for listening.
Indeed.
What do we make of Barbie being blind?
I'm going to have to think about it. I actually don't know. I don't know.
Symbolically in works of literature, that would generally be something folks would ponder on for at least a second or two. What do we, or do we even have a thought of him being blind, giving, oh, go ahead.
Man?
Yes, I am. Go ahead, ma'am.
I'm sorry. I'll be real quick. Maybe it's symbolic of, you know, him constantly clinging to religion. And like Mr., you know, Mr. Fuller says, you know, the religion of white supremacy, and maybe that's why he's blind. Maybe that's really superficial, but that's all I wanted to add. Thank you.
Right on, Red in Nevada.
Quickly, I think that blind may relate to the fact that they said earlier he wasn't listening to his physician's advice. He may have had diabetes, which leads to blindness. He was old, elderly black man, and probably, you know, you can imagine the 30s and 40s, the health, medical apartheid and all of that. Poor health resulted in him losing his sight because earlier he could see when he was traveling, you know, from state to state. I mute my line.
Any other thoughts on the symbolism of Barbie's blindness, if any?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
It may be some sort of reference, you know, I'm not sure, in terms of Ellison, in terms of classic literature, for like, because he says his middle name is Homer, and Homer, the author of the Odyssey, was blind, and maybe it's some, because I think Ellison was really vested in white classical literature and put a lot of these references in his work. But that may be what he's trying to get at. I don't know. But that's what kind of struck me, because the reference to Homer, and then he, right after that, his middle name's Homer, and also he's blind on top of that. And Homer was blind also, the author of the Odyssey. But I could be wrong. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate that. Great point again with the white literary references. Any last comments folks want to get in on that? Barbie being blind? Think on it. If you have a thought, you can bring it up next week, where we will be starting on Chapter 6, Dr. Bledsoe. Wowee, great commentary forthcoming. We'll be on this book for a while, so if you are listening to the archives, if you have questions, or if you want to respond to any of the questions that have asked, or if you have your own questions or just commentary that you want to add, you can email and we'll add as we go. Hopefully we will not have a pattern of tech difficulties or what have you, so that it won't be disrupted when you tune in to listen to the live broadcast. But I think the archive, the recording, should be A-okay if you're listening to the archive. At any rate, we should be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll review the last 7 days on the plantation, what's been down. We should be here Sunday for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. That is the early program to accommodate listeners who are in earlier time zones. So it's 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific, this coming Sunday, May 20th. With that, if you have questions, guest suggestions, if you can't find something in the archive, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com.
untiljustice@gmail.com. I read some of the folks' commentary this evening who wrote in about the book. Can do so. We will have lots of opportunities to read, so feel free to share if you have comments on the brilliance of Mr. Ralph Ellison as we proceed. I did want to make sure I got in just encouraging Black self-respect. We have a lot of that on the program, have a lot of that generally on the broadcast. I think read in Nevada to make sure everyone is being confident, because I think you all made a lot of great observations with the text as you genuinely do. But read in Nevada, I think you said exactly what Dr. Kevorkian said. That was where we started the program at. Dr. Kevorkian, white English professor who has written and studied about this book extensively and admitted to being a racist white supremacist, but he made the exact same observation that the narrator, when he says, when he asks Mr. Norton if you'll need me, he says, no, I won't be needing the machine. He said that right there. The nigrification of Black people, you're not a human being. You're just a thing, a machine, a robot, a zombie, an automaton, exactly what you stated, and just paying attention to how that gets repeated throughout the text and how you see that repeated daily within the system of racism, white supremacy. But be confident with our observations. I think that's something that the system of white supremacy tries to rob us of. I think you see that in the Invisible Man, him being robbed of his confidence on a regular basis. I think that's what we've been observing for the first 3 weeks that we've been reading the text. With that, next Friday, I'm so excited. Looking forward to chapter 6 next week. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Alcohol came up in the book last week. I do not think that that aided the situation. I think there's a long history of racists terrorizing Black people when we are not able to think clearly because of their poisons, narcotics. Let's do everything that we can to preserve our brain computer, the same genius that Ralph Ellison exercised in putting this text together. I think we can exercise towards permanently solving the problem, whites. That said, creator, work. Certainly, if we're going to be in a vehicle, sober and buckled up, that is super important. And I'm a big advocate of doing everything we can to minimize contact with enforcement officials. Make sure if you got your phone in the vehicle that you got your hands-free set up so that you don't get stopped for that. They ticket aggressively for that in Washington State now. So I try to remind Black motorists to make sure that they are mindful about using their mobile devices in the vehicle. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.